recap of the LaRouche 2004 presidential campaign. Welcome everybody today to the audio webcast, which is occurring. We are simultaneously on the web as we are here also in Boston. This week, in a series of sharp, pungent, and forceful press conferences and presentations at New England area college campuses, Lyndon LaRouche, the number two candidate for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States, has done what many had thought impossible, brought thinking back into the mainstream of American politics. As controversial as ever, LaRouche and his LaRouche Youth Movement have, in the recent elections in California on October 7th and Philadelphia, remoralized the thinking portions of the Democratic Party in a winning fight for the removal of Vice President Dick Cheney and his policy of preventive war. As the foremost economic forecaster of the 20th century, LaRouche's ideas on economics and his proposal for a Franklin Delano Roosevelt-style economic recovery, complete with a new and reorganized world financial system, a new Bretton Woods system, have been extensively studied by governments and by leading forces of governments throughout the world. However, although many privately agree with LaRouche and whole factions of government would like to implement his policies, unless we see a paradigm change, a cultural change in the United States, unless Americans make a fundamental shift, a bootlegger's turn, away from the 40 years of consumerism and baby boomer era pessimism, it is impossible that this new set of designs could ever occur. Without the man, you cannot have the idea. And therefore, today, it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you, for those who have never met him, and to reintroduce to you, to those of you who have been following him for years, the man who will be President of the United States in 2004, Lyndon LaRouche.
Well, thank you, folks. Thank you very much. I should just do a few preliminary remarks. I'll address three subjects today. I was going to do something similarly in up there in Vermont yesterday at the university at Middlebury, but they wanted me to shorten the presentation from 3/4 hour to a 30 minutes, which I did. So I left some things out. So I shall give you today a somewhat amplified version of what I said to you as a different audience, what I said to a university campus audience yesterday. And as you will see, there is a significant difference in the way the two points have to be presented. All right, the three points are, which I will touch upon and present here. First of all, the issue of war. And the question is, what is the nature of the policy? When did it start, and what is the policy which has gotten us into a spreading process of war in Asia and probably elsewhere? Secondly, the economic crisis. This economy in its present form is now disintegrating. Nothing can prevent the present IMF system and the present Federal Reserve system from disintegrating. Nothing. But it can go in one of two ways. It can go either through intervention, as Franklin Roosevelt-style intervention back in 1933, to reorganize the system before total chaos erupts. Or we can wait until it simply blows up all by itself. There's a massive effort to postpone that blow-up now by printing money in various ways. The best estimate is that the blow-up will occur probably by March or April of next year, at the latest. The ability to continue to print money to postpone the program will be blown out by then. It can blow out earlier. It can blow out next week. It's ready to blow now. The fundamentals are all rotten. There are no good fundamentals. The United States is the victim of the biggest snow job in history on economics, and we've got Treasury Secretary Snow to prove it. The official liar of the D.C. Third thing is the question of the generation gap. and what the significance is of the difference in the attitudes and roles of principally two generations. One, the generation which came into maturity or semi-adult immaturity during the middle of the 1960s. The ones who are now in their 50s who are generally running the institutions and running government, businesses, and so forth. And the other is a generation which is now coming into, largely into college age, including those between 18 and 25, university eligible age. And it's the conflict between these two generations, which I shall turn to in the conclusion. What the nature of it is, what we do about it. All right, now first on the war itself. As I said, in beginning of January of 2001, before George Bush was inaugurated, George W. Bush, as the acting president of the United States. Whether he was elected or not is irrelevant. We know that Gore lost in any case. But Gore was always lost, and he hasn't improved since. But I said on the basis of his stupidity, the president's stupidity, and its commitments, it was inevitable that the depression, which is already in progress in 2001, fully in progress, would not be stopped. It would become worse. And the danger this posed, apart from the economic collapse, was that, as in Germany, in the events of 1928-33, when the collapse of the economy struck Europe, as it struck the United States openly in 1929-33. In that period, some international bankers, led from London, but including prominent bankers such as Brown Brothers Harriman in the United States, Morgan, and so forth, the Morgan, DuPont, Mellon crowd, they did two things. They, first of all, at the end of 1932, they organized a fund to bail out Adolf Hitler. The Nazi Party was bankrupt at that point, at the end of 32. And so the decision was made from London to bail out Hitler. The bailout came from New York City. It came from the firm of Harriman. The check or the order to bail out the Hitler campaign was signed by Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the present President of the United States. Now, at a later point, the British and American pro-Hitlerites changed their mind. They were perfectly content to have Hitler be a nuisance for destroying continental Europe, but they were not willing to accept his becoming a threat to the English-speaking world. And therefore, as you know, we prepared for war. When Winston Churchill, as defense secretary, appealed to President Roosevelt, we accelerated our efforts to prepare for war. We prevented Britain from joining France and going into the Nazi camp. If Britain had gone into the Nazi camp at that time, then you would have had an immediate unity of fascist forces on the continent of Europe, which would immediately attack the Soviet Union and expected to destroy the Soviet Union in a short time. Once they had destroyed the Soviet Union, they planned to take the combined naval forces of Japan, Britain, Germany, and France, and attack the United States in an attack which was planned to include an attack on Pearl Harbor by the Japanese Navy. This did not happen. That the agreement between Roosevelt and Churchill prevented the British from surrendering to Hitler and started the process which doomed Hitler's prospect for establishing world empire, including the destruction of the United States. Under those conditions, the English-speaking part of the British Commonwealth, as it's called today, and the United States joined fully in supporting the war effort against Hitler. This included Brown Brothers Harriman, reluctantly. It included Morgan. It included Mellon. It included the British banks. Including Lord Halifax, a pro-Hitler man who served as British ambassador to Washington during the war years. It included Beaverbrook, Lord Beaverbrook, who was also a pro-Hitler man, who functioned as British propaganda minister, in effect, during the wartime years. And Beaverbrook, whose progeny today include Conrad Black and the Fox TV crowd, Rupert Murdoch, as the Skyans. So what we have is you have this continuity of a process which led into this war. Now, so I said in January of 2001, the danger is this. They put Hitler into power through these bankers, U.S. and British bankers, put Hitler into power as the Chancellor of Germany on the 30th of January, 1933. In the third week of February, Hermann Göring, who was head of the Nazi Party in Brandenburg, organized the burning of the Reichstag, the National Parliament of Germany. And the burning of the National Parliament was used by under a law devised by the guy who taught Leo Strauss of Chicago University, Carl Schmitt. Hitler was made dictator, and at that point, World War II was inevitable. And we fought it. The danger is that under these kinds of conditions, under these kinds of conditions, as I said in January, we have to be aware of the danger of a Reichstag's fire or something like it in the United States. That Reichstag's fire occurred on September 11th, 2001. Since that time, the United States has been sliding toward dictatorship and war. Now, with the United States, we're not Germany of 1933, and therefore the ability of the chief proponent of the Reichstag's fire approach, Vice President Cheney, has not been able to become full dictator. He does not have full, total control over the puppet president, George W. Bush, Jr., but he has close to it. And therefore, since 2002, I've been engaged actively in trying to have Dick Cheney removed from office. Because Dick Cheney and the neoconservatives associated with him are not only an imitation of the Adolf Hitler movement, they are a continuation of it. As I've identified it, it's a movement that's called in the 20th century, it was called the Synecist. The Synecist organization was created actually under another name called the Martinists in France back in the 1780s. It was created by the British leadership at that time, Lord Shelburne, who was the political boss of the British East India Company and the paymaster of the British Parliament and of George III himself. He planned this operation beginning in 1763 to frustrate what he saw as a forthcoming struggle for independence in the North American English-speaking colonies. The other thing was to destroy France, which was the chief rival of British power in Europe. The purpose of his operation, Lord Shelburne's, was to ensure that the emerging British Empire, that is the British maritime power, representing financier oligarchical private interests, would not only control the British Isles, India and other things they'd stolen by that time, but that it would dominate Europe and dominate the world. Like ancient Venice, like a kind of Roman Empire, a new form of Roman Empire. And therefore, what he did is he planned two things. One, especially once the American Revolution occurred, was to prevent the continued influence of the American Revolution in continental Europe, to wipe it out, to destroy the influence of the American Revolution and the Constitutional Republic. Secondly, to destroy France. A continuation of the operation. It was he, through his agents, who created the French Revolution. The French Revolution was an operation of the British East India Company under Lord Sheldon. They not only created the Bastille event with two agents of Sheldon. One was called Philippe Galité, the other was Jacques Necker. It was done as a stunt to get Necker as the Prime Minister of France, which worked at that time. Then they disappeared from the stage. They were followed by Danton and Marat, who were British agents trained under Sheldon's influence in London, dispatched to France, and acted and even made all their speeches were written in London under Jeremy Bentham's direction. All their orders were British orders. Then they succeeded these fellows by the Jacobin terror, which was eliminated in 1794. Then they moved toward, in the middle of the decade, toward Napoleon Bonaparte. All of these things were done by a group called the Martinists, a cult which was created around this, and this was, and Napoleon Bonaparte was a reflection of that. Since that time to the present, you've had the continuation of this kind of operation, of opposed, trying to destroy the United States. The War of 1812 involvement against us was an attempt to destroy the United States. The other things were done. The war with Mexico was an attempt to destroy the United States. The Civil War was organized by these people to destroy the United States. The occupation of Mexico in 1863 was done from there as part of an effort to destroy the United States. And the thing was not just our country they wanted to destroy. They wanted to destroy the tradition of the American Revolution, of the American Republic, because we represented the alternative model to this Anglo-Dutch liberal parliamentary form of government, which the British ruled. But in this period, what the British game was generally to cause trouble on the continent of Europe in such a way that never on the continent of Europe would a combination of power arise which would be able to challenge British power. After 1865, when the United States had won the Civil War against Britain and France and Napoleon III and so forth, at that point, the British recognized that the United States could never be conquered from outside. Therefore, they gave up on these attempts to overthrow our government by military force or from the outside. Instead, they went to another road, corruption. They tried to get, they got us under the control of the London Gold Exchange standard system. That was step number one. The King of England, Edward VII, at the beginning of the century, used one of his agents in New York City, Jacob Schiff, who designed the Federal Reserve System of the United States as a way of subverting our Constitution and bringing us under control of international bankers, which has more or less succeeded off and on. Roosevelt fought against this, but was not entirely successful. So we have been corrupted, and that comes to the economic question, as I shall show. So the problem is we face an enemy within and without, which are called in the United States today neoconservatives or similar types. They are determined to bring about a world order of a certain type. They have certain military objectives in mind to do this. These are already operational. If this succeeds, if Cheney remains in office, if Cheney remains in office through the coming election next year, you must not expect the United States to survive. It will not. So therefore, we're dealing with something in the continuation of the Hitler phenomenon, the so-called Seneca's phenomenon, whose origin goes back to the 18th century. This has undergone changes over the period, but this phenomenon is continuing. Don't look for conspiracies of any importance from other sources or enemy conspiracies. They are all of this type. It is not a group of this, it's not a group of that. It's a group of private financier interests who, when a crisis comes, say that we are going to collect on our debts, even if it means killing the people. That when government has to make a choice between collecting debts for bankers and protecting the people, this group is one determination. They're going to maintain a system under which they create debts by which they enslave the population, and they're going to make sure that the debts are collected for their benefit promptly, even if it means killing the people. And that's the fundamental issue that defines these kinds of things. That is why every time in the 20th century and since that you have a major systemic financial crisis, monetary crisis, the danger of something like Nazism comes up again. Because some group of bankers hiring thugs, like this thug Cheney, who's nothing but a thrown away jock from a football field, but he's a killer. He's been involved in secret intelligence operations at a high level since he served under Nixon and since he served as chief of staff for Gerald Ford. He is a killer. He's not smart, but he represents killers. And he's the kind of guy that will order you killed. And he has the people working with him who will do the job. That's why so many politicians are afraid of him and afraid to mention his name in public today, because he's a killer. He's very bad-tempered, among his other amiable qualities. Right. Now let's go through these three issues. With that said, the beginning of the present military crisis, the present form of military crisis, starts in about 1928 with the publication of a book by H.G. Wells called The Open Conspiracy. This book was immediately adopted as a policy by Bertrand Russell, probably the most evil man living during the 20th century. These fellows developed. It started with Wells, who was the first one to get the idea of using nuclear weapons as creating a weapon so terrible that people would give up sovereignty of the national government for world government. This is the general outline of the objective of the group in this Open Conspiracy book published in 1928 by H.G. Wells. Russell himself was instrumental in the development of nuclear weapons. It was Russell, for example, who wrote the letter which was signed by Einstein but never delivered to Roosevelt, even though it was addressed to him. But it was this operation which started the development of nuclear weapons. People had ideas of the capability of nuclear weapons before this, but nobody had actually started until Russell wrote the letter. Russell directed all the key people involved in developing the nuclear weapons. There's the controlling people. And Princeton University became a nest of the control, Princeton Institute, rather, for this. So then the war proceeded, World War II. It started with the idea of strategic bombing of civilian populations. That did not go on from the U.S. side immediately. The British started it. The British scientist by the name of Lindemann was the key author of the policy. This is called the strategic bombing policy, of bombing cities, harmless cities. Then they added to that, of course, the idea of using nuclear weapons rather than firebombing as a civilian populations as a way of dealing with this. Well, then President Roosevelt died. At that point, the Mellons, the Morgans, the DuPonts decided to get rid of the Roosevelt legacy. Roosevelt was in bad condition because of his illness. He worked himself almost to death. He was expected to die soon. They did not want Henry Wallace to be the living vice president when Roosevelt died. So in the Democratic Party convention of summer of 1944, Wallace was replaced by a stupid thug, a right-wing racist thug, Harry Truman. And Harry Truman, onset in power, even as vice president, signaled the unleashing of terror bombing, unnecessary terror bombing against civilian populations, such as the bombing of Tokyo, the planned bombing of Hamburg, the bombing of Dresden, the bombing of Magdeburg, and so forth and so on in Germany, other cities. Not the American policy was precision bombing. Bomb meaningful religious targets. But the British policy was to mass bombing of civilian populations, a thing which prolonged the war, because the Germans who were about to surrender were not willing to surrender because of this terror bombing. They were not disposed to surrender at that point. Then came the time Japan was ready to surrender. By the spring of 1945, the Emperor of Japan had negotiated through the Office of Extraordinary Affairs of the Vatican, through then Monsignor Montini, later Paul VI, later the Pope Paul VI, had negotiated the terms of peace, which he wanted. The condition was that the only condition attached to this was that the dignity of the prince, of the emperor, would be maintained. That is, that the institutions of government would concede to almost anything, but they had to maintain the unity of the nation of Japan, which could only be done by keeping the emperor in place. That was the only condition. Once that condition had been accepted, Japan would have surrendered. But the United States refused to make that condition. Though after the surrender, they honored all those conditions. Japan was rebuilt. The emperor was kept in place. Just exactly as had been promised to the Vatican General. Then why did we drop nuclear weapons, the only two we had, on the civilian populations of Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
American and Germany have already
found
the atomic bomb.
No, that's not true. Not true. That's a myth. Not true.
Not true.
Not true.
Why we bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Listen. Be patient. It's wrong. But your information is false. Okay? I'm an expert. Your information is false. I know the area. I know it. In fact. Okay. So we bombed it. Now, what did this do? The objective here, remember, we had defeated Japan. Japan is an island nation with a very small part of its territory is habitable. It's a mountain island nation. We had, MacArthur's policy had been to totally blockade it by air and by sea. This meant naval blockades, it meant submarine warfare blockades, and aerial blockades. Japan reached the point it could no longer get materials it required for the existence of the economy of the island of Japan from the continent of Asia. It could not survive. Its only opportunity was to surrender. It had no military significance. It was a defeated nation, in fact. The question was how to get the surrender through. Well, some people didn't want the surrender. They had another idea. And the idea was dropping those two bombs, which they intended to drop on Berlin. But Berlin was, the war in Europe was finished too soon. They couldn't get the bombs ready in time to drop them on Berlin, which was their original intention. So they said, we'll do something else. We'll drop them on Japan. And they picked two civilian target cities of no military significance, of very much significance, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, this was done as a part of a policy devised by Bertrand Russell. It was called preventive nuclear warfare. The policy, as Russell explained it, in September of 1946 in his magazine published in Washington. The purpose of this was to use a weapon so terrible, nuclear weapons, that nations would submit to world government, give up their sovereignty, rather than face the terror of nuclear weapons. That was the purpose of this operation. Now, from that point on, from 1945 until the beginning of the 1950s, the United States policy was to bring the Soviet Union to surrender by building up an arsenal of nuclear weapons and planes to deliver these bombs upon the Soviet Union, that a preemptive attack, nuclear attack on the Soviet Union, would cause the submission of the Soviet Union to U.S. domination and world government. And that would be the end of it for the rest of the world. Now, what happened was that Truman was an idiot, among other things, his other excellent qualifications. And he tried to bluff both the Soviet Union and China with operations aimed at various points in Asia. He operated on the assumption, as the records of the time show, that the Soviet Union and China would do nothing about it. They didn't have nuclear weapons, and therefore they would have to accept it, and they would not react. They continued the operation. And then as a result of that, North Korea, under Soviet direction, with Chinese communist sympathy, invaded South Korea. The United States was stuck with a few American troops, a Korean army which had been destroyed, and a few American troops in a small perimeter around the southern tip of Korea, around Busan. This changed, of course, when MacArthur did the obvious when he assumed command. He outflanked the situation, outflanked the North Korean army by an assault at the Incheon landing. That changed the situation. But then it went on. We decided that maybe that wasn't such a good idea, that war. Then it was known that the Soviet Union had developed the first thermonuclear weapon, the first deployable thermonuclear weapon. Now, how can you have nuclear fission weapon warfare against a nation which has thermonuclear weapons? Right. So this resulted in the dumping of Truman, telling him, you're not going to run for re-election. And he didn't. It also brought Eisenhower into the presidency, because Eisenhower was opposed to this and represented those military officers and others who were opposed to this so-called kind of preventive nuclear warfare. So we had 8 years of relative stability under Eisenhower. And the Democratic Party was not allowed to have the presidency at that time because the Democratic Party had been contaminated by the Truman preventive nuclear warfare doctrine. Then Eisenhower retired, and people who represented the Russell conception of preventive nuclear warfare, the so-called utopians, typified by Alan Dulles, his brother John Foster Dulles, and similar types of people, began to act. Kennedy had been elected. Kennedy was a very intelligent man, very capable, and showed his promise as he went along in the few years he survived after that point. But at the start, he did not know really what the game was. And he was not a man respected in the military in the way that Eisenhower was. Therefore, he could not have the influence on the professional military that Eisenhower could, in dealing with these utopian warriors, the Air Force crowd, who went to bomb everything, and develop missiles and bomb everything with nuclear weapons. So then we had the 1962 missile crisis. We had then events including the assassination of President Kennedy himself. We had then the launching of the first official war in Indochina. That is, U.S. official war in Indochina. Now, again, the same mistake that was made by the United States, by these warriors, that have been made in the case by Truman on the question that led to the Korean War. They assumed at that point, in going into Vietnam, they assumed that the Chinese would not actually intervene against an American attack on North Vietnam. Therefore, they went ahead assuming they had an easy job. And it wasn't an easy job because the Soviet Union, knowing that it was under attack too, even though the Chinese did not support North Vietnam or Vietnam in general. Matter of fact, they didn't like the Vietnamese. The Russians intervened and assisted to devise a strategy under which Indochina could defend itself against U.S. occupation. Now, this, in a sense, this is what's called asymmetric warfare. And it's asymmetric warfare in the age of nuclear weapons. We had the classic case of asymmetric warfare of this type occurred in 1813. Napoleon Bonaparte, with his Grande Armée, was about to invade Russia, occupy it, and thus subject all European, continental Europe, to Napoleon's own personal domination. At this point, a section of the Prussians, headed by Scharnhorst, decided to assist the Russians in defending themselves against Napoleon's planned invasion. Incidentally, Lazare Carnot, who was the greatest French military man of that period, told Napoleon, don't be stupid, don't try it. He had a general understanding of what the problem was. The Prussian military, which advised the Tsar and helped him, proposed a policy which was developed on the works of Friedrich Schiller. The point was, do not try to engage the enemy at the border. He's got superior force. He's got a 500,000 army dragged up from all over Europe. If you try to have a decisive battle with him at the Russian border, you will be destroyed and he will overrun Russia. So what they said is, don't. Do a rearguard withdrawal action. Trap him into Russia and prepare to destroy two cities, Petersburg and Moscow, if Napoleon goes to either. So Napoleon was put through a rearguard defense by the Russians, which kept him coming on, and he decided to advance toward Moscow. He occupied Moscow and was declaring and celebrating victory when the city blew up, it had been mined. At that point, the Russian people and the military forces which had been conserved fell upon Napoleon, such that when Napoleon was sitting later in Poland, waiting for the last of his army to come across from Russia, one man came across the border, Marshal Ney. And Napoleon said to Marshal Ney, where's your troops? He said, Emperor, I am your troops. All rest of them were captured or dead. That was the end of the Grande Armée. Now, in modern warfare, in the age of nuclear war, when you engage countries at a distance and you can throw large weapons and weaponry against them, that's one kind of warfare. But there's another kind of warfare. Let the enemy invade. Let him try to occupy the country. When he tries to occupy the country, our people are going to be next to him. At short range, thermonuclear weapons don't work. And that's what the Vietnamese did against the American invasion in Indochina. That is what, in effect, is happening now. That's what's happening in Iraq. The Iraqi people are nationalist people. All this double talk about how Saddam Hussein being the big problem, this and that and so forth, Al-Qaeda and so forth, it's all junk. The Iraqi people have gone through occupation before. They were occupied as Iraq as a nation under the Ottoman Empire. They were occupied by the British during the end of the Ottoman Empire. They were occupied, they've been occupied more recently. They were occupied by the British after the First World War. They're occupied more recently. And the occupation of Iraq has strengthened the sense of nationalism. Do not try to assume that difference in religion define the way you can split up Iraq. It's not that simple. Iraqis include everything. You have Christians of various varieties, Armenians, others, and so forth, Christians. You have, you used to have some Jews. They got kicked out in a way. You used to have all kinds of Arab religions, Muslim religions, and Druze, everything there. So, but they all lived together. They had a certain degree of amity among them. They've all thought of themselves as Iraqis. They spoke with quite similar accents and quite similar thoughts. And they were concerned with Iraq as a nation. Any fights they had among these groups were fights within the nation. They did not define a separate nation. They defined a fight within the nation. We have these things in the United States, as you may know, as well. So the Iraqi people are now reacting to the punishing, cruel, unjust war dumped upon them. They don't care who did it, in a sense. They are going to defend their nation. Now, they're also, in a sense, an Asian culture. In Asia, the ideas of life and death are somewhat different than they are in European civilization. And they are prepared to die for the future of their culture, for the future of their nation. That's where you get this suicide bombing process, from that kind of culture. So now you have the American army, vastly outnumbered by the population of the country it occupies, in a country which has over 2 million trained military fighters who are trained as part of the Iraqi military capability. I have a couple hundred thousand odd American troops who are totally incompetent, as most of the troops, for the job. These are point-and-shoot people who can go out in the streets and shoot off a weapon rapidly at even a suspected target, like the Columbine killers. They're trained on video point-and-shoot methods. They don't know how to think. They haven't been trained. They're not qualified. They're not an engineering troop. They're not qualified for anything, for occupation work. They're sitting there, hopelessly. What are they? Are they occupiers or targets? Increasing the shift from being an occupying force to a targeted bunch of people. Frightened, targeted, so forth, is occurring. So what we're dealing with now, when Cheney brought this policy back in after September 11, 2001, and had it sold officially to the U.S. government as reflected in the State of the Union speech in January 2002, we've now entered a new phase in a certain kind of conception of strategic conflict. You have, on the one side, you have what we used to call conventional warfare, pre-nuclear methods of warfare. You had at the other extreme what used to be called mutual and assured destruction. The idea, if you go to thermonuclear warfare full scale, you probably will destroy most of the population of the planet and most culture. So therefore, you can't go there. You can't conduct conventional warfare anymore. It doesn't work because you go to a threshold at which some other kind of warfare, including the use of nuclear weapons, will break out. So the effort has been to find a way to conduct wars between the level of conventional warfare and general thermonuclear warfare. And that's what Cheney is talking about, preventive nuclear warfare in that dimension. We do not, in the United States, have the ability to deal with the kind of reaction that we are provoking with our present forces and our present policy. The United States cannot win the kind of war that Cheney is trying to launch. We'll lose it. Why? Because the reaction, especially in Asia, will be strategic defense, which they will call asymmetric warfare. You're dealing with civilian populations which are prepared to resist in every way. Some of these people represent superior weapons capabilities. Russian weapons, technologically, are very interesting. Some Chinese weapons are interesting. Indian weapons are interesting. But the basic principle is population warfare. If the people of an occupied or threatened territory decide to engulf an occupying military force at close quarters, the United States is not capable of winning such a war. Therefore, you're stuck in a period you either go to thermonuclear war, in which case the planet is generally destroyed, or you don't, and you go into a process of attrition through popular wars in which most of the world falls into a dark age. So therefore, on this kind of policy by Cheney and company, the military policies of Cheney and the Bush administration, and the military policies supported by many Democrats, including Democrats who won't fight it, are bringing the whole planet toward an early dark age. If Cheney continues in his position, with his policies, where the people around him are called neoconservatives, with their policies, if this goes on, if there's an attack on Syria, if there's an attack on Iran, if there's an attack on North Korea, you will see the world is committed, with Cheney still having control over a puppet president, the world is committed to a dark age for all humanity, even on military grounds alone. And that's what we're up against. We're in a situation in which I know there are ways to bring about a general peace on this planet. It's available. It's available to the United States with the right president. I can do the job. I know how to do it. All right, let's go to the second question, economic question. Now, as some of you recall, we came out of the Depression and war and the post-war period under Roosevelt's initiative, and even with the bungling we did after the war, we emerged as the most powerful, productive nation on this planet. And the most powerful nation on this planet. This continued up until after the Kennedy assassination. What happened? The shock of living under a threat of thermonuclear warfare, general nuclear warfare, which had gone on in one degree or another since 1945 up until 1962-63, had produced a tension in the population. In the U.S. population, this tension had been increased by a right-wing turn under Truman. It was not Joe McCarthy who gave us McCarthyism. It was Harry Truman. And it started in 1945-46. It didn't start in 1947-48. So the typical American who returned from war was terrified. He was terrified of going into a new depression. He was terrified of a new war. And they adopted the policy, keep your mouth shut, say what's expected of you, be careful what our children say, be careful who you talk to. We lived under right-wing terror in this United States, and we came to call it McCarthyism. To a certain degree, Eisenhower liberated the nation from McCarthyism, to a certain degree. But the people who had been subjected to this immoral thing, this capitulation to terror, to Nazi-like terror, not like Hitler yet, but in that direction, they lost their souls. They sold their souls. They wanted to get a job. They wanted to be secure. They didn't want to lose their job because of security clearance problems. They went into suburbia if they could. They told their children, be careful what you say, be careful what you say. What you believe is not important. It's what you're overheard saying that's important. Saying the right thing, that's important. There is no truth. It's saying the right thing. It doesn't get you into trouble. Maybe get you a promotion. That's the right thing. So the parents of the veterans generation told their children, especially in suburbia, be careful. So the children born as what became known as the baby boomers were permeated with a great deal of immorality worse than in their parents' generation. Because they had been conditioned that there is no truth. They had been conditioned in Dr. Spock. They had been conditioned in touchy-feely. When we were hit by the missile crisis, and some of you here were old enough to experience that, when we were hit by the missile crisis, for several days, people in this country were wandering around in bar rooms looking for the church, expecting that the thing was going to strike and we were going to be obliterated any morning or any evening. Pure terror. This affected strongly, most effectively, the younger people who were then in late adolescence going on toward young adulthood. The result was a phenomenon called from 1994 on, from the time that the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan stage on CBS, it's called the cultural paradigm shift. Don't accept reality. Go into unreality. We are leaving producer society. We don't want blue shirts anymore. We want white shirts or maybe multicolored shirts. Or maybe no shirts at all. Or maybe no clothes at all. Maybe we want pleasure wherever you can get it, from whomever you can take it. Woodstock phenomenon, huh? Right? So we went into it. We said technology is bad. Production is bad. You've got to have the simple life. Get away from technology. Science is dangerous. So we became, in the process, began to shift from a producer society to a consumer society and a pleasure society. Then Nixon in 1971 sank the dollar, sank the international monetary system. The Azores Conference, which followed, put us into a floating exchange rate system, and then we really got nasty. With our control over a floating exchange rate monetary system, under American and British control, we went to various nations using the London market. We would run a currency down in value, say Mexico's currency, other currencies. who would then send a team into the country, having collapsed the value of that currency on the world market by speculation, the way Soros did to Malaysia in 1987. We'll go, now we've got to have the IMF and World Bank come in and give you some advice on how to solve this problem. And whatever they recommend, we'll support. So the IMF and World Bank would come in, both are the same, one of the others, and they would say, drop the value of your currency. Devalue your currency. I'm saying, okay, we might accept that. All right, but that means we pay our debts in our currency, right? Oh, no, no, no. You don't pay your foreign debts in your currency. You pay your foreign debts in dollars. And now your currency just got devalued. So now you have to accept a larger debt based on the difference between the old value and the new value. Such that, in, for example, in Central and South America, if you look at what these countries owed as of 1971-72, they have more than paid every foreign debt obligation they ever incurred. But they have a bigger debt than ever before, a gigantic swindle. So on the basis of this, we go into a country, we say to China and other countries, drop the value of your currency. What does that mean? That means you're going to collapse the internal economy of that country. You're going to collapse the infrastructure. You're going to collapse the general infrastructure. But you're going to work for us. You are going to be our market. You are going to be our market for our industries. We are going to ship our factories and our farms from the United States into your country, and you're going to work for us for almost for free. And we are going to get all this stuff from you cheap. So we say we can no longer compete with China. We can no longer compete with South America. They can produce too cheaply. Why do they produce so cheaply? Because we stuck a gun in their head and forced them to work cheaply and give up their industries. What happened to the jobs here? What happened to our industries? They're gone. Mostly gone. And what remains is going fast. So we went over this period. For the past 40 years, we underwent a cultural paradigm shift, a change in the character of our nation, from being the world's leading producer society, which was a characteristic of us, traditionally, the characteristic of our economy from the time that Roosevelt assumed office to the end of the war, which continued to be our characteristic of social values into the time of the Kennedy administration. Then we went through a change from a producer society to a consumer society, a pleasure society. We became like ancient Rome after the Second Punic War, where Rome was so powerful and instituted slavery at home, and we've got conditions like slavery here at home today in terms of, what about our homeless and people like that? People who actually earn a living but are homeless, they can't afford a home. At today's rent prices. So Rome degenerated because it ceased to produce for itself and control its population through what we call bread and circuses. What do we have in the United States? Very little bread and a lot of circuses. Television circuses, vast entertainment circuses, sexual fad circuses, anti-sexual fad pleasure seeking, all kinds of things. So we have been destroyed as a nation. We no longer have the productive ability we have. We have vast nominal wealth, but it's basically what we can extract from other countries, which are now going bankrupt. Germany right now, for example, the leading economy in Western Europe, is disintegrating at a rapid rate. Well, I could go into details that I won't hear, but that's the situation. So therefore, we've come to a point where we have this vast accumulation of debt. We have vast inflation in financial values. Financial aggregates are up per capita. Monetary circulation up vast. We're printing money like crazy. We're printing it not by the printing press, we're printing it even electronically. Overnight, vast amounts. The per capita physical output of the United States, per capita, per square kilometer, is dropped. That if you look at what the physical values are of consumption, look, for example, the case the power generation and distribution. The power generation and distribution is collapsing. These industries are being collapsed. To maintain the standard of living and production we used to have, say in New England, we can't do it anymore. The industry is collapsing. We now have a deficit in the United States in terms of capital investment in power and generation, which goes into trillions of dollars. That is to put things back to the point that we can today assure communities and assure households and industries the access to power they once expected. We would have to invest trillions of dollars of capital investment to rebuild the industry and other things. Our transportation system is collapsed. We would have to put in vast amounts of investment to rebuild the transportation industry. Water management, pollution, things of that. So we have a ruined country. We no longer have the productive ability that we once had. We can no longer support ourselves by our own effort. We've become dependent, like the Romans, on stealing from their victims, foreign victims. Yeah? That's where we are. So eventually that has to come to an end. Now what this produces is the following. You come to a point where over the past 40 years, don't blame the government alone. Blame the people. Because who voted for some of these idiots? Who voted for persons who proposed these kinds of policies? Who adopted the idea of post-industrial society? Who promoted it? Who promoted the antipathy to technology? Who called for deregulation? Who supported deregulation? Who voted for guys who pushed it? Who voted and tolerated or didn't vote for anything at all, just gave up? For all the bad things that have happened to us to destroy this economy, to lead it to the brink of a collapse. Who did it? The American people. How did this express itself? It expressed itself as so-called popular opinion. How did it reflect itself? It reflected itself in voting patterns and in non-voting patterns. Over the past period since 1977, the physical standard of living of the lower 80% of family income brackets has collapsed at an accelerating rate. The homelessness, the vast homelessness is only a part of it. The collapse of health care, the collapse of education, the collapse of essential services, the collapse of transportation systems. You can't afford to live in this society anymore. But who did it? Popular opinion. Now, this is not unusual in history. See, mankind is generally ruled or self-ruled by popular opinion. People behave, they are generally, as was described by some sociologists, as other-directed. They borrow their opinions from their neighbors, like cups of sugar. They say, well, what do you believe? Whatever you say. Whatever the news media says. I got to go along with the news media. I've got to go along with the party. Right? Other-directed. Now, we have destroyed ourselves not because some people have introduced bad policies, but because we tolerated them. Worse, we became supporters of bad policies in the name of supporting public opinion. I got to go by what the newspapers report. I've got to go by what my neighbors tell me. And that's how we do it. That's called public opinion. We're destroyed. All right, so what does this mean? This means that in history, there are cycles which occur over a period of generations, one generation, two, three generations. Cycles in which wrong opinions will build up, take more and more control, more intensely over a population and its behavior and its leading institutions. The society then appears, like ancient Rome, to be in the process of destroying itself, as we are today. Then what happens? Do we survive? Well, in 1933, we survived. In the 1932 election, we elected Franklin Roosevelt, who told the world pretty much what direction his policies were going to take. And we had enough gumption left in us after the shock of the Depression to support him. At least the majority of us did. He made a change in our culture. He made a shift from the culture of the 1920s, the flapper era, to the culture of the 1930s and the 1940s. So we abandoned a bad kind of public opinion, came back to our senses to a large degree, decided we have to have a healthy producer society, and it worked. It worked just fine, with all the flaws in it. We emerged again as the leading producer society and the greatest power in the world, the greatest planetary power. Now we've come again to the point. We, out of stupidity, have destroyed ourselves. This has gone on for about 40 years in particular. There were other things earlier, but 40 years of this culture. The prevailing culture. That means that you are presented today with politicians in general who, reading public opinion, will always have the wrong response. This means that the lawmaking process will usually give you the wrong law. The election will usually give you the wrong candidate elected. And that's more and more the case. Why? Because public opinion. But what is this public opinion? It is the public opinion which has developed and accumulated like an avalanche over the past years. And now, if the nation is going to survive, it has to change its public opinion. You have to introduce values which are contrary to what is generally accepted. If you don't, the nation is not going to survive. If you don't, something can happen here, as happened in Germany in 1933. That's the process. This produces an interesting problem. The generation, the so-called baby boomer generation, which has accepted this change, are now in their 50s. They are looking forward to comfort. Most of these comforts are illusions. I mean, you take a guy, say, in Northern Virginia. A lot of areas of the country have been despoiled. It's not possible to live in these parts of the country. I'm just looking at some of the parts of New Hampshire and Vermont that I passed through in the past days. I mean, you have to call some of these things that people are living in hovels is like calling them palaces. You have people who are living in conditions of life which are unbelievable in the United States. You can see that in those who occupy hovels off the road in the backwoods of Vermont and New Hampshire and elsewhere. Right? That's the typical situation throughout the country, one way or the other. But then there's a worse level, the homelessness. We're getting people who are getting into a quarter of the population is moving toward the direction of homelessness. Are already there now. Extreme poverty. But you have a population of the baby boomers, the ones who are in the upper 20% of income brackets or in that ideology, say, oh, no, that could never happen. What is typical of this thing? You see, somebody goes out of these poor areas where there are no longer any jobs, and they move into an area where jobs are available. This means that in certain parts of the United States, we have housing booms. Now, what is the housing? Look at it closely. Some of you who know something about construction. You put up something which qualifies as a potential tar paper shack, probably a little larger than a usual tar paper shack. How do you hold the thing together? You wrap it with shrink wrap, which is called insulation. How do you make this piece of shrink wrap garbage look like a house? Well, you take some plastic exterior, about like 1/16 of an inch thick slab, painting, paste it on plastic, make it look like brick, make it look like something else. When you get through with this process, maybe putting a couple of gold-plated faucets in the luxury version of this house, it goes up for a mortgage value, let's say, $400,000 to $600,000. And some poor guy who has moved in from a poor area of the United States to get a job in these areas, probably in the IT industry or something like that, and the two members of the family at least are working. The house is very seldom occupied. They're all usually working on two or three jobs most of the time, or when they're not just plain commuting on these parking lots called our superhighways. Right? And this is what's going on in this country. Now, the values of these houses, recently it became ridiculous because people are not really getting by. Despite their high salaries, so-called, from IT and so forth, and despite two members of the family working all kinds of hours and commuting all kinds of hours, they really can't make ends meet. So along comes some real estate dealers, and along comes this man who should never be allowed out of his bathtub. That is Alan Greenspan. He'd never come clean otherwise. That comes along, and they start pumping money into the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac operation, mortgage. Then you have real estate dealers who are in on the racket. These real estate dealers then say, no, the values of housing in this area has gone up. Suddenly the bankers call up the mortgagees, the mortgage people with mortgages, and say, hey, your house has just increased in value. Why don't you remortgage it? You can get some cash. So people in various parts of the country have been buying their groceries from these areas by cashing out, based on an appreciation in the nominal value of the mortgages. Nothing actually happened. Someone said in the real estate community, these properties here are now increased in value in this area. So the banker in the area who is in on it calls up the people with the people bearing the mortgages and tells them, well, you can get some money. If you just refinance your mortgage, you'll get an increase of several thousand dollars or whatever, and you can put that in your pocket. And they use that to buy groceries and things like that. Now, what happens when it goes the other way? You're turning homeowners into squatters, and if they're lucky. What happens if you have a vast collapse of employment in these areas, which has been oncoming since the beginning, middle of about March or so of April of 2000, year 2000? In the IT industry. So we're in the process of a general collapse of the financial system in which suddenly everything hits more or less at once. We can survive. I know how to make it survive. Anybody who understands Franklin Roosevelt knows what approach to take. We can intervene in a collapsed economy. We can keep it functioning. We can make it grow again, as Roosevelt did. It'll be tough going, but we can do it. All right. Now you have, but the baby boomer says no. The baby boomer says, I have things I have come to believe in, values I've come to accept, lifestyles that are important to me. I'm not going to give them up. And it's not going to change. You're going to see, it's not going to change. Look, things have been going this way for a long time now. It's not going to change. People aren't going to change. You're wrong. You're wrong. It's not going to change. You think they're slightly hysterical? I do. All right. So do their children. See, children in the university age, eligibility, 18, 25, never really talk to their parents much anymore. They don't consider it consider it a waste of effort. They won't listen. Because the young people in that age, if they're, and they have a lot of problems, but the young people in that age recognize that they have been given, by their parents and others, been given a society with no future to it. All you have to do is talk to young people. Talk about the drug problem in society. Not the way the baby boomers talk about drug problems, but the way these young people talk about drug problems. It's not somebody passing out drugs in the neighborhood. That's not the problem. That is a problem, but that's not the problem. The problem is the country is saturated in affecting these young people with a drug culture. Who did it? Well, what about the school teachers who pushed Ritalin in schools? Told children and the parents they would have a penalty if their attention deficit child didn't get Ritalin in a compulsory way. Or how about some Prozac, which can turn you into a vegetable in a couple of years? How about other drugs? How about all the people who are taking psychotropics of one kind or another to manage their emotions? I don't like my wife. Take the drug. You'll feel good. This is the kind of thing. But so the young people are afflicted, not only themselves, but among the people that they have concern for of their own generation, younger siblings, friends, so forth. The drug problem is a threat to their lives in ways that the baby boomer generation, for say from the 60s, from the Woodstock generation, would never understand. But they see in other ways that they see a no education system called education. They see a no future society. Therefore, these young people are ready to make a change. Now, as you know, in the past 4 years, I built up the organizing of a youth movement. It started in California, and it grew. I was very careful about it. I kept the youth movement largely away from my older associates, not people older than I am, but people who are younger than I am, because I knew they'd make a mess of it, because they would try to impose their values upon these young people. And the point was is to find a context in which these young people would think for themselves and work through problems for themselves, as if in a university on wheels. So it worked, started in California. We had these sessions, often by telephone, long cadre sessions, other arrangements. And we began to develop a youth movement. Then a couple of years ago, in the sorting out process, we had a movement. It worked in California, and so I said, fine. We'll replicate it and build it in the East Coast, too. And we started to do that. Now, in the case of California, for example, as you know, there was an election out there, a recall election, organized by a bunch of thugs. And it featured a certifiable thug, a monster called Arnie Schwarzenegger. He's a monster by profession. If you've seen his movies, you know that. So we were determined to defend the state of California against this recall, the effects of recall election, because Arnie was among the people who stole the money in California. And he was going to come in to fix things after having stolen it. And his friends were the big thieves who raped the place. But the Democratic National Committee was of a different persuasion. They told Governor Gray Davis not to really fight. He could have fought. He's a kind of candidate, the kind of politician who can win a fight like that. But they told him, don't accept my advice. And he backed off a bit from that, though he was happy to have my support. So we concentrated on, with our youth movement especially, on two areas, Los Angeles County and in the Bay Area. Now in Los Angeles County, at the time we started the fight, the polls showed the vote going 60% for Schwarzenegger and company and 40% for Davis. By the time the election we carried Los Angeles County, not just us, but our role in there was crucial. We carried Los Angeles County 51% against 49%. We did better in the Bay Area. In every other part of California, generally, the whole thing was a disaster, and Schwarzenegger became elected governor. But nonetheless, we had demonstrated that where our youth movement was deployed and engaged with other political forces, that the addition of the youth movement to the combination of the political fight meant you had a winning combination as opposed to what you had otherwise, which was a disaster. On the basis of what we had did in California, Mayor Street's organization in Philadelphia, coming under attack from John Ashcroft, invited us to help them. So I said yes immediately. We put the forces in there, and as a result of this combination of both, again, our people working with their people to make a combination, the combination of the youth movement in the context of the other forces meant we had a relative landslide victory in something that was a cliffhanger at that point. What I'm illustrating by that is today, the young people of the type represented by the youth movement, my youth movement, are the most powerful political force per capita in the United States. Why? It has to do with what I just told you. An older generation, now in their 50s generally, has gone through a long cycle of corruption. They become accomplices at the destruction of themselves and their society. They see no future. They don't have any sense of immortality. The sense is that when they go, they go. And if grandma is costing too much money because of her health care problems, she should quietly go away. Because it might take our money away if we had to support her in her sickness. That's the society. That's the baby boomer society, the culture, the characteristic of the upper 20% baby boomer population. It's indifference to life. This lack of sense of immortality, the sense of, yeah, we're all going to die, but let's be decent about it. Let's die decently. And let's make our lives meaningful by giving something to future generations and by honoring the best contributions from past generations and seeing to it that they go on and live on and benefit future generations to come. The baby boomer generation, especially those in this upper 20% bracket, do not have those values. They lost them somewhere between the missile crisis and some other things and what's happened up to date. They are dominating government. However, they are still human. They are still worth saving. Right? We're trying to do as much as we can in that direction. The best way to save them is to have them meet young people who represent the generation of people who would be their children. These young people typify for anyone the future. We're all going to die. So what becomes of us? What becomes of our having lived when we die? Can we hope that we have contributed something which will live on of benefit to future generations? Can we believe that? Well, how can we believe it? Well, have we done something worth continuing? Number one. Number two, who is going to carry on? Well, what do you do then? You're looking at these young people. With all their problems, their drug problems, all these afflictions, you look at them. This is your immortality. These young people are going to have children. They are those grandchildren of yours. That's your immortality. It may not be your personal immortality in one sense, but it's an expression of the fact that you can commit your life presently, even under great difficulties, to the sense that you're doing something which will not be wasted. Because there's someone coming after you, a couple of visible generations which can carry on and make the meaning of your life something for the future of humanity. That you know something that you can help transmit to these young people. Something from the past, which is a treasure from the past, a cultural treasure. You pass it on, and they will see to it that it's preserved for the future. And thus you have a sense of immortality. You are openly in connection with the past of humanity, you're in the connection with the future of humanity. This gives you not a sense of doing something because you get a reward, because you get paid, because you get a benefit. This gives you a sense of a mission in life. We are all going to die. We're all born. We're all going to die eventually. Therefore, what is important to us in our life considered from that standpoint? What is important is adopting a mission and using this life we have as a talent, an asset we spend. For what do we spend a life that we're using up? What future purpose is served by our living? What is so important that we can die with a smile on our face, saying we've defeated death, because we have contributed something that will live on after us, and the whole of our life means something. See, we become a society, a corrupt society, a pleasure-seeking society, which is looking for rewards, looking for gratification, Well, I, you know, that was years ago. This is years down the line. I got to think about now. You know what I mean, buddy? I got to think about now. This is my community now. I got to think about what I feel now. Look, this woman just left me. I mean, that's my problem. Maybe she was right. Right. So this is the problem. We have gone from a society which is looking at what we get, what we desire in the short term, the pain we're trying to avoid in the short term. That's been the way we've gone, the way this culture's gone. What you need is a sense of mission which understands the essence of human life. We're not animals, we're not beasts. We can develop ideas, we can make discoveries. No beast can do that. So therefore we have the sense of having a mission in life, that we are going to use our life and spend it wisely for some purpose which is presented to us as an opportunity. We're going to recognize that opportunity. We're going to devote our life to that opportunity, to fulfilling that opportunity. And we're going to have a sense of mission about what we contribute to the future of humanity. These young people, by representing that, particularly when they represent that in the way they approach life, become then, in that way, an inspiration to the older generation by giving back the older generation access to a sense of this kind of personal immortality in society. This may not deal with your religious sense of the matter, but it does complement it. And it does define the meaning of citizenship. And think of the three principles of the preamble of the Constitution: the sovereignty of our nation, the sovereignty of our republic, the general welfare of all of our living, and the security of our posterity. When we, in our own lives, are meeting the requirements of that preamble and understand political society as something which should be ordered accordingly, and read the intent of the Constitution that way, you understand why this republic, until now, is the only republic whose constitution has survived over the period from 1789 to the present in the world. No other nation in the world has a constitution which has lived as long as ours. The vitality of our system of government lies in the principle and purpose of that constitution, that we are committed to the sovereignty of peoples, that each nation should be sovereign. We are committed to the general welfare of all people, treating none like human cattle. All are human, and their welfare is a concern of all of us. We are also concerned about what we leave to posterity, not just to our present gratification. This is the underlying moral strength of the United States. My mission, among all the other things I must do, is to revive that sense of mission of the United States in as many people as possible. Thank you.
In recognition of the role of the LaRouche Youth Movement, what I want to do at this point is I want to have Abdul come up, Abdul Muhammad, who what he will do is he'll tell you a little bit about what's been happening for the last few days on the campaign trail with LaRouche. And then what we're going to do is we're going to go right into questions. What we'll do is we'll take the first four questions from young people, and then we'll open up the floor in general. So, Abdul.
Yeah, say a couple things and then, you know, take it over.
Okay, hello, my name is Abdul Muhammad. I'm, of course, a member of the LaRouche Youth Movement. And, you know, the past few days have been pretty interesting. We've been organizing different events in Vermont, New Hampshire, for LaRouche's presidential campaign. And basically telling the youth that the victory in Philadelphia and the victory in California was due to actually taking the ideas of Mr. LaRouche and giving people the sense that we can change the U.S. And of course, the youth movement on the East Coast completely bashed Ashcroft in the Philadelphia election. And that's one proof of principle, which LaRouche just discussed. So what I would like to do at this moment is to take a few questions from the youth in the audience who have something to ask Mr. LaRouche.
The microphone right here.
Middlebury.
<Yeah.
laughs> Well, it was interesting. The Youth Democratic Club and the Republican Club invited Mr. LaRouche to Middlebury College in Vermont. And I believe about 100 people showed up. And they were only expecting 50. And the event...
They were
huh?
They were students of the college.
Yes, yeah. Yes, students of the college. And Ms. LaRouche gave a wonderful speech, and you know, despite the questions, I thought it was an actual good event. A lot of people walked out who were serious, and they wanted to find out more about LaRouche and the youth movement. Danny?
Hey, Ms. LaRouche. My name is Danny. I just had a question about this idea of what you were saying before, this idea of truth as being lost. You find it, it seems like most people tend to be obsessed with the idea of interpretation, that what was meaningful 500 years ago based on those circumstances is different today. The idea of perception is the idea of what makes something what it is. So I just want you to talk about how do you reach people to say that there's more than just, you know, arbitrary perceptions. There's actually an idea of truth.
What I've done with the youth movement is address explicitly that problem among youth. The quality of education in universities and secondary schools today is abysmal. I've had some exposure to it. It's just they have no conception of truth whatsoever. As a matter of fact, you're in a society which is increasingly existentialist. And the existentialist does not believe in truth. The existentialist believes in personal experience and the emotional reaction to the personal experience. So how someone feels about something as to both what's true is more important to the existentialist than what the truth is. Now, so therefore there's a loss, there's no sense of truth in the prevalent popular culture of the United States today as practiced. What you get then is this. The problem is that people think that sense perception is truth. Did you see it? Huh? Did you smell it? Did you lick it? And of course, obviously, any animal would, if they could respond, would respond in that way. But human beings are not animals. And the idea of truth does not exist among animals. Or some politicians, I fear. But anyway. The question of truth is a question of the difference between man and the beast. We as human beings, we have our sense perceptions, but we know, as Plato emphasized, that our senses are simply part of our living organism. And therefore, they only show us the shadow of what happens, that is, the impact of the world on us, on our senses, our sense perceptual apparatus, gives us an image of the reaction of those sense perceptions to the stimulation. Now that we find things like this, as Kepler did, this Mars orbit, you know, from a simple standpoint with precise measure, it seems that Mars is going along quite nicely in a kind of elliptical orbit. But then at a certain point, it loops, goes backwards for a short period of time. And that occurs regularly, and that's one of the great phenomena that you delight in showing students when you take them out to introduce them to astronomy, to get them all the time that occurs. Or the best thing to do is get at least a replication of how that looks, what that looks like when it did occur. These paradoxes show you that the way in which sense perception suggests that the world operates is not true. And therefore, you confront it with these paradoxes, like the looping of the Mars orbit. You have to discover the principle. Well, Kepler, from that basis, discovered the principle of universal gravitation, When you discover a universal physical principle and are able to verify it, the deficiency physically, now man's will, by utilizing and applying that principle in a willful way, actually can change the universe. Because you can introduce a condition into the universe which did not exist except for man's intervention. Now, when man discovers a principle in the universe which admittedly existed before man existed, and man comes to know that principle and is able to use it to change the universe in a way which is, especially one which is beneficial to mankind, you have changed the universe. And that is why mankind, when if he were an ape, would never have exceeded several million individuals on this planet at any time. We have reported now 6 billion living individuals or more on this planet. How did that happen? How do we have 3 decimal orders of magnitude greater population of mankind than would be possible for any kind of ape? The difference is man has the ability to make discoveries of universal physical principles. Man has the ability to apply these principles in order to change the universe in a way which is beneficial to mankind or beneficial to some other purpose. Therefore, that is the definition of truth. The ability to discover a validatable universal principle and to know how to apply that principle once discovered in a way which is beneficial to man, that is, which improves the conditions of the planet for man. That is our standard of truth, in our physical standpoint. There are 2 levels of truth, however. One is looking at the physical universe from the standpoint of ourselves as an individual observer or intervener in the universe. There's another way. Many things that we accomplish, most of what we accomplish as people, cannot be done by individuals as individuals. It requires cooperation. It requires setting up structures in society which enable this to happen. Like long-term capital investment is not something done by individuals in isolation. Physical investment. So therefore, you have to study the way in which human behavior is able to organize around physical discoveries in order to bring a result which is beneficial to mankind. So now we discover social principles, including principles of classical artistic composition. And this is the second class of principles. And these things we also call truth. The function of the classical drama, for example, take Hamlet. Everyone has recognized since ancient Greece. Pardon me, we have a little traveling around, you pick up a few coals and they get a little phlegm as well. Hamlet. The principle of classical drama is not to present fantasy, but to present reality, but in a special way. You find that, for example, Shakespeare's plays were all either based on actual history, like the English histories from Henry II to Richard III, which pertains to the emergence of modern England as under Henry VII. And then there are legends like Hamlet, Macbeth, Lear, so forth, which are popular legends, but which are embedded in the culture of some people. So you put these things on the stage as history. You always pick a legend which deals with the leaders of society, as well as others in the society. So now you're the person walking into a theater, you get up in the balcony, say, of the theater, and you watch this drama. Now, if it's well done, when the drama opens, you're no longer looking at the actors as such. Visually, you're looking at the actors. But actually, in your mind, you're seeing the action on stage in the imagination. You're seeing it on a different stage as reality, as Shakespeare describes this in the chorus at the beginning of Henry V, in the chorus part, in the imagination. So what happens is the person is watching this and becomes engaged in this drama and sees the society as in a tragedy, for example, destroying itself, and how various people in the society are acting to destroy themselves or destroy the society. And now this individual came from the street, probably just an ordinary person, who has no sense of power over society. He doesn't know what government is. He's thinking about himself and his neighborhood and his friends. But he's up there, say in the balcony, looking at this in the imagination. He's seeing Hamlet enacted. And he sees something. as in the third act soliloquy. Hamlet says this and that, and then he says, however, I dare do nothing about it. I'm afraid. When we shuffle off this mortal coil, when we die, what happens then? And that makes us tremble and lose courage. So therefore, he sees in the unfolding of this drama, a leader of a nation, Hamlet, faced with a crisis of a nation, who's unable to stop the crisis, even unable to stop his own behavior contributing to the crisis, because of his fear on the question of immortality. But the fellow sitting, the citizen sitting in the balcony, looking upon this, is now looking at a society from the top. His concern is, how could we prevent this? How we could prevent this society from making this stupid decision? And through presenting history, actual history, and presenting other things in a dramatic way, through great classical art, we are able to elevate people from little people into becoming people who have an overview of society and see themselves as people who should be doing something about what happens to society. Say, I'm not going to be a little person down here watching my society destroying itself. I, as a citizen, I'm going to try to do something and find a way to intervene to cause those who lead society to stop leading us to destruction. And that also becomes the most important kind of truth, the type we deal with, say, in political processes. How can we intervene? Here I am, look. I know that if any of these characters who were running for president, say, on the Democratic ticket, my rivals, if any of them were to become president, the United States at present is doomed. Because they are committed to values which will fail. And therefore, my question, your question, is how do we intervene in this situation, a nation which is about doomed? How do we intervene in this process, seeing this stupidity, this self-destructiveness going on? What do we do to try to save this nation and this people from the destruction we see onrushing in the period ahead? That's truth.
Yes, hello, Abdul. My name is Abdullah, too. I'd like to ask Mr. LaRouche if he had the opportunity to restructure United Nations system. What are those changes that he could offer?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the history of the United States, we had the work of John Quincy Adams, who summed up a lot of the basics of this problem. As Secretary of State under James Monroe, he took a larger view of his previous experience as a thinker and as a diplomat, because he was Secretary of State and had responsibility for the foreign relations of the United States. So he wrote this draft, which President Monroe read aloud, as became known as the Monroe Doctrine, which is his work. Now, Quincy Adams' conception in this period and later on was that the states of the Americas, which are all under threat from Europe, one side from the British side, the other side from the Habsburg side, what was our policy? And Adam said at that point, we do not have presently the strength, the military strength, to intervene to kick the Habsburgs or the British out of the Western Hemisphere. But we are committed to the establishment of sovereign republics in this hemisphere. And we are for the exclusion of any intervening foreign power from Europe to come in and try to take over, recolonize, and recontrol this area. So therefore, he defined a doctrine which he called a community of principle among sovereign nation states. Now, that's my doctrine. It has two features to it. One, simply on the top. The situation now exists, as I know directly from my dealing with people in Asia and elsewhere, Russia, Europe. The situation is such, today we are prepared, under the right president of the United States, to secure the negotiation of what some people try to call a multipolar world. which I think is a bad term, though I understand the intention. What we need and what we can establish is a system of sovereign nation states which are individually sovereign. No super government, no world government, no super agencies, but which are united by certain common principles which we are in the process of working out. So that's my policy. And the other level of this thing is the question of why do we use this concept rather than the concept of, say, United Nations or super government or some agency to arbitrate nations. I'm not opposed at all to the function of the Security Council. I think it's very useful to arbitrate certain threatened near wars or similar kinds of conditions. But that does not solve the problem. The problem is to understand culture. Why should we have nation states in the first place? What do we lose if we don't have it? Well, the answer lies in language, or it's explained to us in language. You cannot understand a culture or a language culture from a dictionary, from a book on grammar, because the essence of ideas expressed in language is in the form of irony and metaphor. Now, irony and metaphor is the double meanings and triple meanings which languages convey because of the background of usage of that language by a people. So therefore, the stories, the favorite stories, the legends, the history of the people are transmitted so that when something is said, the language is interpreted from the standpoint of the culture. If I want to communicate actual ideas among people in a culture, I must utilize that in that culture, not use broken language, but in that culture, in order to convey ideas. If we don't convey ideas to one another, we reduce ourselves to something like animals in a cage. So therefore, the important thing is, even though people, they come up with the same ideas, if they have a different culture, they have to know the idea, not simply copy it. They have to know it in terms of the experience of their own culture. Therefore, each people must be sovereign in the process of deliberating on its ideas and principles. But there are certain principles which are known commonly to us among governments. Therefore, these principles should form the basis for a community of principles which we all agree to support. For example, principles, the idea of sovereignty, preamble of the Constitution. The idea of general welfare, again, preamble of the Constitution. The idea of our commitment to posterity, again, in the Constitution. These are typical principles of the type along which a community of principles can be built among nations as well as within a nation, among the people within a nation, a system of government. And that's what is needed. My view of the possibility is optimistic. One of my leading personal purposes has been for many decades now to bring that state of affairs about. It's what I did when I was trying to work with the Non-Aligned Nations Movement to bring about a resolution on a just new world economic order of that type. Same thing. You want to protect and strengthen the sovereignty of nations, not dilute or weaken them. But you want to bring those sovereign nations together around a process of accepting certain principles which we can negotiate. We agree these are natural law principles, and we all ought to respect these things in our dealings with each other.
Let me just mention before we take the next question, because I see one or two people have to get going. We, as you can tell, are now in the hot phase of the campaign, and I think based on what Mr. LaRouche has prepared over the next month, and what I understand to be some of the responses we're getting from the Democratic National Committee, we may find ourselves by December in the nuclear phase of the campaign. Now, we require to be able to escalate our activity, well, we're going to escalate our activity, but we require to have the resources to do that. I think everybody here, many of you here, have contributed to the campaign, and you know that the limits in terms of the contribution are $2,000 per candidate. Some of you are aware that Mr. Dean has recently stated that he intends to abandon the matching funds limit and intend to try to seek to go into the deep pockets of various of the upper 20%, thus abandoning the final illusion that he in any way represented a so-called people's candidate, that is to say, a human candidate. But in any case, we're in a position to, over the next weeks, deal a mortal blow, finally, to that neoconservative faction that is operated around Dick Cheney. We're going to need the resources to do that. We're asking everyone here to make a contribution today. Some of you have already contributed your full limit. I'm aware of that. I see one or two people who've done that. We thank you for that. But we want you and others to work with us now to organize to get the necessary funds that are going to be needed over the next period. We've upgraded our requirements, and we're going to upgrade our deployment. So that's what I wanted to say. There was a questioner. You wanted to ask a question? You can come back to the... Hold on, sir. There was a man in the here before you. Let me just get it.
You talk about education in the United States of America right now. How are you straight to education in this country? I mean, we have something called the MCAS test. What do you think of the MCAS test? You heard?
No, why don't you elaborate on what you're referring to?
The MCAS test, that people have to pass the MCAS. You have to know how much, how to do good in math, history, and so forth. And you have to pass a certain point average to graduate from high school. The year 2003 is called the MCAS test in the United States right now in Massachusetts.
Okay.
And how would he improve and only be able to not pass an MCAS test because they're not being taught well?
Yeah.
How would Deloach make a better education for the people of this country?
We got it.
Okay, very good. Very good question. Well, first of all, I don't believe in multiple choice questionnaires. They're incompetent by nature. Anybody who would issue one or use one as a testing standard doesn't understand education. So I would ban multiple choice questionnaires from the school system. Absolutely. Now, what would I do instead? What I would do instead is what I do. If I'm teaching a course, say at the end of a semester, what am I going to do for an examination of the people who've been sitting through, working through their semester's program? I'm going to be very, very tricky. I'm going to have a three-hour examination in which you go into a room for 3 hours. We don't go out. Sit there for 3 hours. I present you with five questions about subjects you should be able to answer, but you don't have had no education in beforehand. Huh? And you can choose any three of the five you choose to answer. Then we will study your answers later. What I'll be looking for is your ability to solve problems which you have not been rehearsed in solving. What I'm testing is I'm not testing you as much as I'm testing the teachers, me included. In other words, have you been given the background to be able to solve an unfamiliar problem for which, in my knowledge, you are really pre-prepared to undertake? And that's what any good examination is in any university or any secondary school. Now, the point is, the essential thing in education is not what you think, but how you are able to think. Because you're going to deal with most of your problems in life, you will have no education in what to do. People go out for a job. I want a job, okay? You go into a plant which produces a product you've never seen before, a production process you've never seen before. Can you do that job? That's the test. All right, can you? If you have been developed as a person to a certain level of knowledge in a certain way, you can go into a place with an unfamiliar kind of work. You say, yes, I think I can do that. Why? You've never done it before. Why do you think you can do that? Because you have been educated and developed in a way otherwise, in such a way that you know how to deal with certain kinds of unfamiliar problems that you've never faced before. You know, you study it, you work it, you sweat it through. And that's how we got through World War II. We put people into jobs they'd never seen before. We challenged them to adopt skills they never had before, for which they've never been trained. But because they were intelligent people, and because they had a certain background, those who were skilled in this thing would recognize this person can probably do this job. Let's give him a chance. Let's give him a try. If that doesn't work out there, we'll try him over here on this job. And that's how we got through. That's how we got the job done. So the problem of education today, and you're giving the right answers to approve some mass testing program, mass education program, is actually a form of destroying your education. So I agree totally. We should ban this kind of education. It is more costly, yes, to have smaller classrooms, to have better trained teachers, and to have the kind of educational classroom in which that kind of thing I described as the testing works. All right, but it's worth it. Because the people we're educating are the people on which the future of our society depends. It's worth everything to get the job done right. So what we need essentially is a new educational policy, which means more teachers. It means a much higher standard of teacher education. Yeah? It means a smaller classroom. It means more preparation time for each of the teacher. Yeah? Go back to more preparation time where you have, you know, the teacher has, say, 8 hours a day. The teacher has actually 4 hours or 5 hours at most classroom time, 3 hours in terms of other work. The teachers are sent and given sabbaticals to go off and get additional education or go into new places and try a new country for a short period of time to get a broader experience. We used to do things like that. And the best schools all did that kind of thing. So I simply say we go back to what I described. I mean, what I said is not unfamiliar to older generations. The idea in the advanced, a good high school education or a good university education to give a student at the end of a semester a 3-hour examination with, say, 5 questions of which the student can choose 3. And these will all involve things the student was not actually trained in that course, but which the student should be able to take on. And you don't grade the student for the right answer. You grade the student on the basis of the student's ability to come up with a credible approach to solving the problem. If he's on the right track, he won.
There's one thing I'll offer to people if you want to do this. I see people standing in line, and I think one other person was up and sat down. If you're welcome to stand in line, that's fine. We can also have somebody take questions or take the names down. Maybe, Chris, you should do that so that if people, we have their names, then they can come back to the microphone when they're ready to ask the question. We can do it that way. So, sir, go ahead.
Hello, how are you? My name is Ken Thomas, and I'm an atheist. I'd like to ask Mr. LaRoche to consider a question that was proposed by a judge, Robert Bork, in his book, Coercing Virtue, where he says that there is no rule of law or constitution in America. There's only the rule of judges, and that they rule by their own opinions without constraints by the law.
Well, you know, you had a fellow in Scotland. There's a famous story written by Robert Louis Stevenson. It's a story based on a true account. It was called The Resurrection Man or The Body Snatchers. And these two guys were robbing graves to get bodies to sell to medical schools for education. And the one was called Burke, in real life, one was called Burke, the other was called Hare. And they took to, being short of bodies, they manufactured a few from living people. And they had a special method of killing people so as to leave few marks. That one would, they cover the victim's mouth, sit on his chest to make it difficult to breathe, and actually cause suffocation or heart attack by that method. And the method was called Burking. And what you're described is called borking. The two things, one is done intellectually, the other is done otherwise. So, this guy, there is a principle of law. And this is one of my big gripes about the selection of federal judges, particularly when it comes up in the Congress, in the Senate. It's just that. They check them on what their sex life is like, or some other foolish thing, and they come up with a list of things, as we saw with, you know, with this process. They don't go at the question, do they understand what the principle of law is? There is a principle of law. And the danger is, these guys actually are fascists, like Bark. Because they have the same argument. You can get this in Thrasymachus, in Plato's Republic, that the idea is the power to make law is autonomous, is exerting power. Our conception of law is truth. The conception of law is natural law. We are not. I mean, some people try to sell British common law in the United States. The United States is not based on common law, not our tradition. We sometimes took into account common law, but it's starting in Massachusetts in particular. It was the jury system, which was started in Massachusetts, the grand jury system, with the idea that the jurors could define what was presented to them, what they considered to be the law of the matter, the fact of the matter. So yes, there's a process of law, of judgment, a process by juries, a process by judges, but they have to be constrained to some principle that they're serving. The principle in our law is supposed to be the sovereignty of the nation, the general welfare of all the people, a principle of equity in respect of general welfare, and the notion of posterity, and a principle of equity in respect to posterity. We have to consider the society as a whole. We also have to consider the individual in the society. Is the individual getting equitable treatment in service of the benefits to the society as a whole? Our courts are monstrously corrupt. We have a number of honest judges, well-meaning judges, but we also have five characters, right-wing characters on the Supreme Court, whose conceptions of law are those of the very close, like Scalia is the worst of them, very close to the conceptions of the Nazi judges. There's no real difference between them in principle of law. These guys are virtual Nazis. You have four weak, well-meaning fellows on the Supreme Court. I would propose to change the Supreme Court composition as soon as possible.
Hello, I'm Sean Shannon from New Hampshire. I have a question on truth, and I talk a lot with my family, my friends, about truth. To help them see this, I read St. Nicholas of Cusa, many of other things. And it's hard to get them to care about this truth and how to get them to see the importance of it. And I was wondering if you could help me out.
Oh, sure. I think you do know something about it already from just what you said just now. You see, when you're organizing, what do? An optimal organizing is not just one-on-one. An optimal organizing involves a group of people. And what happens is you create a dialogue. And I've recommended, for example, the idea of having 15 to 25 people in discussion groups on dialogue. Then if you're going out in the street and organizing, is to carry forth this idea of dialogue on the street. Because somebody says something. The guy passing by stops and reacts. Then another one with you realizes what the second guy has said and has an insight into what's wrong with his thinking or what's wrong with his argument. Or we often see the guy who said didn't really mean what he said. He didn't believe himself what he said. So then you get in the process of dialogue and you're trying to get down to the point that you sort of begin to trust each other, the people in the dialogue. And you start to bat back and forth in a critical way, like a Socratic dialogue. And you get into an approximation of truth. Then you can come back and get back, let's get down to the hard question of truth, which is typified by this Gauss fundamental theorem proposition. There was, at some point, you have to get a very clear idea. You say, all right, now we know that some things are more truthful than others. We've had a discussion, the five and six of us, the 12 of us. We've had a discussion. We now have a sense of what is relatively truthful. But is what is the truth as opposed to what is more truthful or less untruthful than what we started with? And then you have to have a sort of an absolute criteria. And the absolute criteria is simply that the difference between man, between the imagination, the real imagination, that is Kepler's imagination, to recognize a principle of gravitation you can't see or touch as such, but you can control it, you can use it. Therefore, that is an absolute. So therefore, you have these ideas of the idea of the absolute truth, that is, the nature of man is the absolute truth. That we have the power, despite our ignorance, to discover principles of the universe which are true. And we can use these in useful ways to help mankind. That's the principle of truth. Therefore, when you look at the guy, other guy, who says on the street, you know, he says, "Do you admit the country has a problem?" He says, "No, the country's fine. It's going good, great." How do you like the unemployment? You must love the unemployment then. It's spreading around here. You must love the fact the factory down the street just closed down. You must like the fact that the health care is being cut. The people are dying because of the cuts in health care. So you can get a relative truth in a sense that truth is important. But it always comes back to the social principle. What is good for society? Or what is justice for some individual? It's a relative truth, which should spark or whet your appetite for a more absolute definition of truth, which is why I introduced this idea of using the Gauss 1799 paper to get a sense of what do we mean by truth? What do we mean absolutely true in the sense that there is any absolute quality to truth? And that's the only way to approach it. It's a social process, and people should become happy as in the sense of working through a Socratic dialogue. Happy in the sense that, you know, all the mishmash and uncertainty and corruption that you deal with, all the meaningless babble that goes on among people that you read in the press and so forth, to sit down and be comfortable because you're discussing with people one another honestly in the search for what is meaningful. And then out of this sense of what is meaningful, then you say, what do we really mean by truth? And so it's a relationship between the social process of dealing with social situations and then coming back, now, what is the scientific truth? And that's the difference between that distinguishes a true scientist. People who have made great discoveries in physical science would often spend much of their life working out one discovery of great importance, that is relatively. And they did that because they had a sense of a search for an absolute notion of truth, at least relatively absolute to that question. And we approximate that in life with a lot of people who try and simply to sort things out, shall we say, and be honest with one another, looking at things from a human standpoint. What is man? What's important about human people? How should we care about society? Why should we care about this guy over here? Why should we care about this question? So it's a process. It's not a simple thing. To me, it's very clear. Well, I'm an older geezer. I have been around and doing this, practicing this for a long time. It's relatively easy for me. But for you younger guys, the experience of getting there, for older guys, the experience of having nearly gotten there is good. But for you younger guys, the process of getting there is the excitement.
Okay, next question from Stephen.
Hello, Mr. LaRouche. My name is Stephen Hanley, and my question is, what do you propose to do with the American prison industry that is continuously growing, unfortunately, every year?
Doesn't it make you think we're creating a slave society? And with these, well, let's say the case. Of course, you've got discrimination. The most acute discrimination I know of is against so-called African-American males under 35. Then you have something similar among people of so-called Hispanic Americans, males, who are also getting the same kind of treatment. So what we're doing is we are, in a sense, grinding up an essential part of our labor force. Do people realize how many people of the so-called category African American have lost everything, their voting rights, and so forth, as a result of this process? Do you know what the rates of conviction and incarceration are, which are based on these kinds of discriminations, of so-called African-American, Hispanic-American, the highest rates of discrimination? Do you realize what percentile of the community and their family members are hit by this crap? No, we have the criminal justice system has become a crime. And the prison system, look, the prisons no longer believe in rehabilitation. Now, when you get young offenders, so-called, first of all, the guidelines should be repealed. The federal guidelines on sentencing. It should be totally repealed. It's a straight, crazy idea. To work back to the judges, as imperfect as the judges may be, we have a legal process, and with good lawyers and a legal process, we can fight it from court to court and get fights of some kind of justice. But the guidelines are wrong. A guy is a young guy, 16, 17, 18. He's classified as an offender, sent into some kind of an institution. He's sent in for a long time. He's worked over. The conditions in these prisons are evil. It's evil. Dumb guards brutalizing prisoners they're afraid of and trying to control by various methods. No process of development. What about the family? Many of these young guys are married. They have children. We're creating a situation of reproducing criminality because of the effect of incarceration of a male on the child of that family. We're breaking up the families. We're denying people access to decent employment because of these conditions. You know, when somebody commits a crime, which is not a major felony, they get slapped once. That should be a lesson to them. And no more than that should happen. They should be able to progress toward a recognized form of rehabilitation as rapidly as possible. They should be able to put their lives together again while they're still young. And keeping them in prison is costly, it is not worth anything, and it's destructive. It must stop. You want to find criminals, we can find them among the upper reaches of the Democratic or Republican Party, if you're an idiot.
Good afternoon. My name's Sean. Nice to meet you. I have a few comments upon your views of the American Revolution. You tend to have a more Gordon Wood type of view of the American Revolution, pre-revolutionary utopia. I was wondering, you tend to comment a lot about John Quincy Adams, a lot of the Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, but you don't take into consideration what they didn't do for themselves for the American Revolution. For instance, the perspective of the American Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, was the free people. Yet people were still enslaved afterward, for instance, slave, indentured servants, Indians were being pushed off their land, etc. So there were more women were still they were still kept in their homes, kept from voting rights and stuff like that. I'm wondering why you don't take that into consideration.
Okay. Well, this is a question of history. What was the condition of life of mankind throughout the known history of this planet prior to the American Revolution or prior to the 15th century? Human society has been historically in all cultures, in all ancient, medieval cultures, similar times, has been a few people treating other people as human cattle. This has been two kinds of cattle. Cattle you hunt down and kill, or cattle you enslave in some way or other. For example, the typical case of what is a typical person in society, even today, under these present conditions, the present neoliberal free trade image. The average person is treated kindly. As a cow is treated kindly, by a farmer. Huh? The cow is allowed to go into the field where it can enjoy munching on grain, grass. Huh? It's allowed to go into the barn where it is milked. It's allowed to enjoy the services of a bull. And if the bull has found that the progeny of the bull have weak feet, that bull is sent to the slaughterhouse quickly, and his pleasure comes to an end. And the cow gets a little bit old, doesn't give so much milk, well, you know what you do. All right, so therefore, this is a philosophy of, shall we say, Kinney, Francois Kinney. This is the philosophy of Adam Smith. So what happened, the American Revolution was a breakthrough, as before that, the 15th century Renaissance was a breakthrough. That the condition of humanity in so-called traditional society was unspeakable. People were treated as cattle. In the United States, from the beginning, from the inception of the United States, we were engaged in a fight. The process of trying to get the people of the United States and others to elevate themselves in their appreciation of humanity. And this process worked here. It's our strength, our commitment to the idea of sovereignty, general welfare, and posterity. Now, we were under European influence, under the influence of the British. They tried to destroy us until 1863. They began to give up after Gettysburg and saw they weren't going to destroy us. Other nations of the planet tried to destroy us. The Habsburgs, the Austrians, the Spanish, the others tried to destroy us. We survived. They corrupted us. We survived. So the United States is not a utopia. It never was a utopia. I would never present it as a utopia. To me, the United States is a process of uplifting humanity, a process whose intention was, as Lafayette expressed it, to found in this nation a republic which would be a beacon of hope and temple of liberty for all mankind. The purpose of the existence of this republic, which was created largely by leading Europeans who committed themselves to support Franklin, particularly in this process, was to establish in North America a republic which would be a model, an inspiration for other parts of the world to achieve the same thing. And to build a community of nations which would take humanity finally, at last, toward the objectives which are specified implicitly in Plato's dialogues, toward a system of sovereign nation states in which the rights of the individual are generated, not arbitrated, but generated by a process of human development. And that's what we are. We are not a utopia. Look today. Look at any part of our history, but look at the history of any country. Look at the virtual slavery practiced by China. In order to maintain an income from the United States for the future of China. But a certain section of the Chinese population lives under horrible conditions with very poor wages. They're exploited as almost like cattle. The Chinese will rationalize it and say, yes, this person is suffering. That's their destiny. But it's not wasted, because their sacrifice, as in war, is considered a contribution toward a nation's development and its people, which will lead to great benefit in the future. For example, the morality of the Chinese government today, the best leaders in it, as I've discussed this with some of them, and they agree, China thinks in two generations, not one. Generation number one is to develop the infrastructure of the interior of China, to free China from slavery to the coast into poverty, to develop new cities, transportation cities, vast water projects, power projects, and so forth, and transform the poor land of the inland area, and even the desert areas of Turkestan area and so forth, to transform this into a living space for a more advanced condition of life of the Chinese people in general. They see correctly that it will take a generation of capital improvements to make this kind of a state of affairs possible. And it will be a second generation before it's realized. So overall, the policy of China today, in this term, is positive. They are thinking about sovereignty, culture. They're thinking about they're thinking about general welfare in relative terms. They're thinking about posterity above all. We look at the cheap labor that China is using to get income from the United States by producing what we used to produce for ourselves. We don't produce it anymore. The Chinese went to an American firm, which a market firm, which opened up in China, and the Chinese were very angry. All they could buy in that firm was American goods, which were made of cheap labor production in China, and they were very unhappy with the place. They wanted some better goods, which we weren't supplying them. So that's the process. We have to look at, you have to look at this as a process to define a nation, a process of development. Where we come from, where are we going? And this has been a great nation, and my objective is, if I'm president, it will be a great nation. I can assure you. I'm a very gentle person, but I'm a very resolute one.
Next question.
Oh, is it a follow-up?
Oh, it's okay.
I think I'm a Native American major, so I think you have some good points, but I think the prospect for authentic democracy already had survived so long, and especially during the Native Americans, the Iroquois tribe, the Iroquois Confederacy, which survived for so long. Benjamin Franklin actually stole the ideas, didn't get them right. Karl Marx stole the ideas. Jean-Jacques Rousseau stole the ideas, but they didn't get them right. And I think there's a reason why they didn't get them right. And the reason is that the intention was not to free these people, that the intention was to remain, was to keep people exploited for the profit and benefit of others. And I guess the prospect for authentic democracy did survive for so long, and I suppose that there was an alternative reason then.
I got you. Well, see, the Soviet system is a good one, but not a good one. The problem is the Soviets, because of the influence on Karl Marx, various things, and Engels in particular, the Soviets never understood, nor the Marxists ever understood, the nature of man. And that, though, the point was, you know, you look at it. Say, how did the Soviet Union come into existence? It's historical. These things, see, questions like this, you really require historical examples to understand them. How did the Soviet Union come into existence? Well, it started with the King of England. The King of England, Edward VII, made a plan for a war with the purpose of destroying, mutual destruction of the nations of continental Europe. He died before the war started, but the war started and became World War I. And in this, he managed to orchestrate a war among France, among Austro-Hungary, Germany, Russia, so forth and so on, and the British were involved. In this process, you had this fellow called Lenin, who's sitting off there in Switzerland, and saying that if the war occurs, then the result will be, the Tsar will be overthrown, but no existing political party in Russia, which tried to replace the Tsar's regime, would do anything but fail. Why? His argument was, essentially, that these governments would, first of all, refuse to get out of the war. They would stay in the war. Secondly, they would not deal with the crisis, the internal crisis, of the people of Russia. And therefore, all the other parties did fail very quickly, and he took an institution, which including the Bolshevik Party, and he took an institution which had not existed prior to the overthrow of the Tsar, the so-called Soviets. It was a voluntary organization of soldiers and others. And he made that the government. So you had the Soviet system, which was operating largely under the influence of these Marxist ideas about the nature of man and so forth. And therefore you would have, looking back at the Soviet Union today, as I've seen it, you would find Soviet science, military science, was excellent. The achievements of science were excellent, but this is the work of intellectuals. But the problem of the Soviet state was anti-intellectual. And therefore, when it came to the ordinary production, which is not military, it did not have a military objective, you had the old same thing going on all along. So you had corruption and decadence. The point is that humanity functions, human relations function, not on the basis of treating man and fellow man as an animal, but treating man as a person of ideas, of developing ideas. The conception of society is to produce an intelligentsia. Under Marxist law, or Marxist principles, the intelligentsia were bad. Therefore, you needed them like cows to milk. The average working person in China, in Russia, was more highly paid than top scientists, with very few exceptions. They put scientists in prisons called gulags, explicitly for the question of squeezing science out of them by oppressive methods. It worked to some degree. So the problem in Russia was, look at the question, what was wrong? What was wrong with the dynamic, even though the certain aspects of the criticism of society by the Marxists was correct. Lenin's criticism was correct of the Tsarist regime and the various liberal parties. But they didn't have a positive conception of man, because they defined man as Engels defined man, as being merely an ape that had learned to use its thumb. That's the problem. So when the society proceeds from the wrong conception of man and tries to say, let's order things equitably and justly among people, that doesn't work. What's your definition of man? What is the requirement of the individual human being as an individual human being? What is the function of a human being that distinguishes him from an ape? And that's where most societies have failed. They back off from the fact that the human being has a mind, essentially. And it's the development of that mind and the use and promotion of that development of that mind, that individual's immortal contribution to society, that is the truth, that's mission of life of that person. And a society which is not dedicated to the mission of life of the individual members of that society will fail and will lead to abuses of the type you describe. So the problem does not lie in the formalities of it. The problem lies in the content.
Gene Shannon.
Right here.
How you doing, Len? I heard you say you're an old geezer. I asked you a question one time, probably almost 20 years ago, when you were on the Larry King Live, and I asked you how you were doing. You said, pretty good for an old geezer. You're doing pretty good for a much older geezer now, too, I want you to know. I'm happy to see you still so mentally and physically well. But at any rate, I'd like to ask some specific quick questions concerning how do we extract ourselves and solve immediately the problem of Iraq? And I know that's probably going to touch upon Palestine as well, but specifically, what advice are you given immediately for the Bush administration or the future LaRouche administration?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't have much of a problem at all, because people in the Arab world and elsewhere know me pretty well. And I can deal with many of these countries where no other candidate in the United States could, because I have a personal standing in these countries where they respect my honor. All right, now, first of all, we got to get out. Period. Out. How do we do that? Simply. If the United States would have sense right now, if I could go to Bush and get him, stand beside him and say, here's what you're going to do, Mr. President. I could do it. We could solve it. Not nicely. It's going to be a mess. But we can solve it. We're going to get the United States out, because the United States has lost credibility with the Iraqi people. Therefore, you cannot stay in there without being shot. They're getting out. Now. Not next summer. Now. And secondly, we're going to go to our friends in Europe who we slapped in the face earlier this year in the United Nations Security Council and others. And we're going to say, okay, we want you to take your part in this. We're going to discuss with you how we're going to manage the reconstruction of Iraq with the Iraqi people. And the first thing I would say, rehire the Iraqi army. Not just to be an army, but to rebuild their own country. and we have to mobilize the resources to rebuild the country. You know, go back to the principle, which used to be the principle of European civilization, the Treaty of Westphalia, the so-called advantage of the other. The way to win, not war, but to win peace, is to think about not what we can get out of the other fellow in the negotiation, but what we can give to them that will be valuable to them. And that works both ways. If we decide, if I were president, it would be easy. They would accept it. A lot of people would accept it. A lot of neighbors of Iraq would accept it. Most countries would accept it. China would accept it. Russia would accept it. India would accept it. The Arab world would accept it in general. Most nations in Europe would accept it. If I were president right now, I could give the orders right now. And we could have the conference and we could be out of there in fast, in quick order. The war would be over. And the rebuilding would begin. It's that simple. The problem is that the philosophy is wrong. We've got to prove ourselves. We've got to stick to it. And the problem is also Cheney. The problem here is a practical matter. To go one step beyond what you're saying. Go behind that. Why isn't that being done? Why isn't Bush saying to me, Bush knows it. He doesn't know it, but his advisors know it. They know what my influence is in the world on these issues. You can read it in the press from all over the world. You can get it from leading diplomats, leading political figures all over the world, what their attitude is toward me. So if somebody simply reports that to the relevant people in Washington, and if they had any brains, they'd be coming to me and saying, we want you standing beside the president in a White House press conference, which is making certain announcements about a discussion. It's a private discussion recommending the following. And the president would say, I think that's interesting. I think we ought to look at that. And it would happen. The problem is, why isn't it happening? Because you posed it as a hypothetical question. Right? How can we make it real? The problem is we have an impediment. What's the name of the impediment? Cheney. Because Cheney and the neocons don't want the peace. They want the hell. They want to spread the wealth. They want the Iraq situation to become worse. Paul Bremer, who's no good, but he's stuck in there with the responsibility for the thing, is now signing on to tenets, CIA official tenets report on the area. He's pleading, get me out of here. Get us out of here. Let's change the policy. Because he doesn't want to be stuck with the blame for the operation that he's been put on. But the Cheney and the neocons are for the extension of war to other countries now. As I said earlier today, prevented nuclear war. If we can eliminate that factor, then the door would open up for the kind of things which are no longer hypothetical. And that's what my problem is. The problem is largely in the Democratic Party, because if the Democratic Party would not act like a bunch of jackasses, or bad jackasses, we would have put enough pressure as Democrats on the process, we could turn the situation around.
My name is Nancy Vora. My question is, how could the society work with the children at school if the parents don't have a power to educate the child?
Children in school if the parents don't have the power to educate their own children.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I think we discussed some aspects of that problem today with questions and so forth, as well as others. The problem is, you take the practical question. We have whole sections of society in which the parents have no power. For example, a mother with a husband who's in prison, for example. And this is common. I mean, in the whole parts of the country, this is a raging problem. People who've been emasculated, men who've been emasculated in prison, and they're our children. People don't pay attention to the effects on children of having a father in prison and the effect of that on the community. They don't understand that. Then you have the whole system stinks. The whole system of education stinks. The political system sinks. For example, if you're in the lower 80% of family income brackets, you're really already in trouble in this country, serious trouble. if you have a family in that status. What happens to you? What kind of a school do you get? Well, the thing is private schools. These are various kinds of private schools, which are no good anyway. But people like the private schools because they think their children are not going to be brutalized there physically. So it's like putting them in a hawk shop all week while you're away at work, hoping you'll get your child back at the end of the week when you come to redeem it. That's what these schools are, sort of a hawk shop for young human beings. Now, the problem is that the attitude of society is such that we do not, like our health care policy, we do not have a sane health care policy. We do not have a sane educational policy. We do not have a sane attitude toward the people in the lower 80% of family income brackets. That's what the problem is. And therefore, we don't have, no respect for parents. You sure? Well, look at the drug problem. How much of this do you think the drug problem has to do with it? What do you think about Ritalin in schools, compulsory Ritalin, compulsory Prozac being prescribed in schools? What about the drug problem on the streets? What about the drug problem and this way this spills on in the schools? It's not the way that the Woodstock generation understands it. It's a different kind of problem. This is a drug culture. I mean, a real drug culture. And our children, those in their adolescence and younger, and those in their 20s, are faced with a drug problem. Not because they use drugs as such, some do, but because the whole society is filled with all the complications that flow from having a drug problem spreading like a disease among them. So what we can do essentially, I hope that by our raising these kinds of issues and making them hot button issues, we'll get attention to them, the usual squeaky wheel kind of business. That's what we can do immediately. First thing is for us to understand what the problem is and for us to make a fuss about it, because it is a problem. It's a frightening problem. I mean, parents see their children being destroyed. But one of the basic things which comes out of people like Gunnar Myrdal out of Sweden, the orientation of society is to break the authority of the parents over the children. And to turn, it's like the use of 10 and 12-year-old children in Africa as soldiers to kill people of their parents' generations. What Museveni did in Uganda, for example, which is happening all over Africa. Boy soldiers, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old guys with an automatic weapon, trained to use it, out to kill. The fact that this goes on gives you an idea of what the attitude of society is toward children and the way the attitude toward family life. No, it stinks. We've got to take back charge from the top down of society. We, not me, we have to take charge.
Are there any other questions given? Okay.
Hi, I have two questions. One is, how can you change the dictator country to democracy country? And another question is, could you explain me about a little information about Mekong River Project?
Mekong River Project.
Oh,
yeah. Just tell her what that is. She doesn't know.
What's the first one?
The first one is, how can you take a dictatorship and make it a democratic nation? Right?
Oh, what? I don't use the term democracy too much. I'd like to talk about freedom more, because democracy sometimes is enforcing popular opinion upon people, and sometimes popular opinion is wrong. So therefore, I'm much more for the independence of the individual, and then forcing society to come to an accommodation in terms of reasonable relationships among differences of people, rather than trying to put some mold of if the majority votes, you all have to believe it. I think that's wrong. But I do the question of the value of society, which places the value on the mind of the individual and the development of the mind of the individual and the creation of opportunities for the individual to express that developed mind in useful ways in society, which becomes, in a sense, of identity. and respect for the dignity of the other individual person is the more essential value and the cultivation of the conditions of life. Now, the Mekong River development is tremendous. This is a tremendous project. It reaches into the southern parts of China, all the way through Southeast Asia, because these areas are connected in many ways by water systems implicitly. This would open up the whole area in terms of power management, water management, and so forth, for a great increase of productivity. It is one of the great projects of Asia. It's been sticking around for a long time. People have recognized the Mekong system, which starts essentially in China. But this runs through, is connected with or runs directly through most of Southeast Asia, out of China. So this is the natural relationship, economic relationship of China and these areas. Also, this includes implicitly Myanmar. It includes a relationship to subcontinent of Asia for cultural and other reasons. Remember, there's a lot of Indian culture in Southeast Asia. For example, an Indian culture as well as a Chinese culture and so forth is very important inside Thailand, for example, that you have a similar kind of thing in other parts of Asia. So that there are relations among all these states, cultural and similar relations, and therefore the Mekong River Development Project as a development project would involve the participation of these various nations in various ways in the project, in helping to develop it, or in the economic relations which would flow from it. So it is actually a revolution in Southeast Asia, which is comparable to the intention of China in developing the interior of China, that there is now in large-scale water management, power systems, better mass transportation systems, and so forth, new conceptions of urban society, new kinds of industries. All of these things go together, raising the standard of living to make a transformation of the whole ruined region of Southeast Asia as well as China. To me, it's a wonderful project, and I've been looking for it for a long time. And in a recent period, there was an agreement to start the project.
Are there any other questions? And if there are, this is the final one. Okay, we're going to take this next two questions and then close our program. Go ahead.
Thank you, Dennis. Stephen Hanley from Massachusetts. The other Stephen Hanley was not an apostle, that was my son. But I want to commend you, LaRouche, on bringing into your campaign the CCC camps that Federal Franklin Roosevelt introduced during the 1930s. I personally knew a fellow who dropped out of school who was in those CCC camps. He traveled to over 40 states, cleaning up the environment, building bridges, became a World War II veteran hero. He was one of my mentors on a bowling league, and he was always thinking, always asking questions. Are you mechanically inclined? Are you thinking about the future? Where others were just saying, I'm here at the bowling league, just having a good time, and get drunk afterwards. But that's what you do for us. You allow us to think. And as a baby boomer, I was against the baby boomers growing up because my dad was born in 1909. At age 50, he was playing ball with us. He was able to articulate, always encouraging us not to be discouraged. I must commend you over all these years with all the degradation, all the embarrassment the youth we had to endure from the corruption, from our mass media, from the liberal establishment on the left and the liberal establishment on the right who doesn't care about any of us. You have stood the weather of time.
Thank you.
And number two is how can we do, you know, in my imagination is I would like to have an intervention on the networks. We are now here to give you an emergency broadcast report. The Lyndon LaRouche movement is now about to make an announcement to save your soul, this nation, and the future of this country. How can we intervene somehow for 30 minutes from the networks dominating the blah, blah that we continue to hear? Thank you.
Well, really one question on that, but it is pertinent to the whole event here today. And that is that Look, what's happening with the way I'm doing this policy of traveling for the campaign, what I'm doing is conducting events. Can I be excused for just a second? I'll be right back.
You can be excused, and I can do what I have to do.
No, I'll be right back.
I am.
Okay, okay. I just have to.
We'll get an answer in a moment. Hey, you know, everybody's human. Well, while we're waiting, actually, let me simply say, because the person who largely was responsible for you all being here today, and who's not inside because he's at the registration table, Bill Ferguson, should be commended for what he did. And I'm glad to see you think so much of him, so I'm sure you're going to make sure you see him on your way out for your LO4 contribution. Seriously, for a moment, just on the question of the campaign, just to say, and Lynn will give you a lot more on this, the Democratic National Committee is, let's just put it this way, quite concerned about Mr. LaRouche and his travels. And they're very concerned because as people get a look at the candidate and they mentally compare him to what else has purported to be available for the nomination, he sort of stands head, shoulders, waist, and knees, maybe even ankles above everything else that's out there. Now, so what we have to do is we have to treat this campaign in the same way as all the other campaigns which think they're going to win are treated. In part, I know that Lynn will say this himself, he has his own view of this, but we're doing something I believe that's even more powerful, far more powerful actually, than the media, with the youth movement. And that youth movement, he has said, should grow, should escalate to first 1,000 and then 10,000 young people by the time that we get to the spring. He's actually looking at that as being sort of the bracket, if you will, or the container of the primary period. And all of you can help us with that, because all of you can help us in terms of recruiting young people, bringing them around, and bringing them into that effort. So just to fill in there, think about that while we get the answer to the question.
Okay. The way I'm doing this is, as much as possible, I'm trying to get a series of video events with the following thought. There was some problem that may be resolved, I don't know. Some problem at up there in Vermont at Middlebury, about the president was under pressure from the alumni, did not wish to have the video of the thing released without his permission. But otherwise, what we're doing is in going at each of these events, my view is an event location such as this one is a pinpoint. It's a pinpoint on the geography of history. By capturing these on video and putting these on videos on the website where they can be drawn, you have the following effect. First of all, the younger generation, which is the driving force of any effective campaign now, is actually people in the youth movement generation, or slightly older. They're very much oriented to the large-scale use of the internet. You find that the mass media, the mass television media and other media are less. People's social behavior has changed in terms of meetings and so forth. So they rely more and more on this convenience of the electronic mass media, that is the internet part of it. So therefore, I consider my responsibility is to improve and build up the websites of the campaign so that people can draw upon the full video of the event in each case, to not to portray what the audience is doing and so forth, but to actually show what my policies are in different places in the country to different kinds of audiences. Because the message is essentially the same. The audiences are different, the circumstances are different, new developments have occurred, have to be reported upon. But thus, when you play back, say, do an event in Boston, you play it back on video, through the internet, through the website. Now what you've done is you've done two things. You've made a presentation to an audience in Boston, an action in Boston. Now you are now playing back the national and international circulation of the report of that event back to the location where it occurred, as well as to other locations. You're also giving the population in general a sense of the reality of the issues, to judge the consistency and differences and problems that arise in the course of the campaign. We have a very large population in the United States, which has to be reached. Physically, you cannot, in a process of 1 year or so, you cannot reach directly most of the people of the United States. We're the people that any president of the United States must represent. So therefore, there's a technical problem of how do you get to these people. Now, I invented the so-called informational, as you know, back in the 1980s. I had more half-hour television broadcasts on national TV than all other candidates put together. And that did shake up and shake the operation, so they decided to kill me as the best way of stopping those television broadcasts. But today, since then, there's been a change in the cultural change. The mass media no longer has the influence over the population, the electronic mass media, that it had 20 years ago. It's gone. This is not CBS of the 1950s or the 1960s or the 1970s. That's gone. Most of the stuff is junk. Well, people have been relying upon more on local media, local newspapers, talk shows, things like that, local radio, or on the Internet. The younger people are relying largely on the Internet. So therefore, my point is to put the material of the actuality of what we're doing in the campaign on the Internet, on the website, so to reach probably the broadest audience, or the most important section of the national audience, which is young people, people under 35, under 30, especially under 25. This is the most important section of the population, for reasons I say it here today, and as I've stated before. It is young people, like those in the youth movement, who have demonstrated, as in California, as in the case in Philadelphia and so forth, are the most effective people per capita in the political process in the United States today. If the young people, those young people, get the message, follow the campaign, see themselves reflected in what I do in various areas, they are the ones who will do the mass organizing among the majority of the population, and that's my best chance on reaching the largest possible part of our population. And that's what I'm doing. So we're going for a change in technology. This is it.
Okay, is there a final question?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
I have more of a brief statement, and you can comment on it. I see that we're in a state of war in this country. We're under siege. We've been the victims of unrelenting assault, which has been going on for the last 25 years or so. And the people who are waging this war against us are the corporations, the politicians, the bankers, and Wall Street. I see a massive divestment that's been going on, and it's been accomplished by a number of means, a number of methods. It began during the Reagan administration. It's been the exportation of jobs, defense spending, continuous defense spending, deficit spending, where the last 10 years we've averaged $300+ billion a year in interest, which is not purchasing anything, but it's just enriching the pockets of the debt holders. I've seen the savings and loan scandal. I've seen the recent tax cuts that are enriching the corporations and the rich. They're not paying their fair share. I see the recent scandals on Wall Street and the corporate scandals, which is another method of divesting and extracting a massive amount of wealth in this country. Now, I see our jobs going off to China. The majority of the clothes that I'm wearing here, and I venture to say the majority of other people in this room, are products that are made in China. But these are not Chinese brand name products. These are American brand name products, but they're being made in China. And they're being, for pennies on the dollar, 25 cents an hour, and they're being sold for exorbitant prices back here. Can you comment on any of that? I think we are being, a war is being waged against us, and we need to fight back more aggressively to do something about it.
First of all, we have to get, yes, that's all true. Question is, how do we approach it? Well, the issue is what? The issue is that the spread of the Anglo-Dutch liberal parliamentary system and its effects internationally. What is the system? During a long period of time, from about the time prior to the Norman conquest of England up until late in the 17th century, Europe was dominated by an alliance between the Venetian financier oligarchy and the Norman chivalry and its outgrowth. This was a tyranny. Now, what happened was, because of the defeat of the attempt to have a reform in France, as proposed by Bailly and Lafayette, a constitutional reform of the monarchy, and because of the French Revolution, Europe never did what we did in the United States. They never formed a true republic. Never. They weren't able to. Because what happened as a result of all these wars and so forth, a system developed to supersede the Venetian model of control of society by a financier oligarchy, like the Venetian oligarchy. Result was that this moved from Venice, as Venice declined in influence, to the Dutch and English shores, especially through the Dutch India Company and the British East India Company. During the 18th century, this system became the dominant force in Europe, the Anglo-Dutch liberal system of parliamentary democracy, which is based on three elements. Two are reforms of feudalism, in a sense. One, a state apparatus, the queen or the king and the apparatus. They make substitute a president for the king, it's the same thing. It's a king by any other name, is a king. Right? Second, you had the parliamentary system. It's a reform of a feudal parliament. It's something which is dismissed at the minute a crisis occurs, because it cannot really govern. And then third, the third force, is what's called today an independent central banking system. The independent central banking system, or what the Federal Reserve System is in large, in effect, is nothing but a collective representative of private financier interests, largely through private banking functions. These banks collectively exert veto power over government, especially over parliamentary government. This is a form of society which is largely a predator faction in society. They suck the blood of society. Now, this is what came out of the British intervention in France by Lord Sheldon in creating the French Revolution, in creating what we call fascism in the 20th century. Bankers faced with the threat that reforms in government would put the power back into the hands of the people and away from the hands of the bankers, bring us to a point in which the financial system tends to collapse as a result of its own follies. At that point, the question is, who is going to pay the debts? Are the debts going to be paid by the folks who caused the debts with a bad system? Or are the people going to be compelled to pay the debts out of their own hides? If government threatens to defend the general welfare of the people, then the bankers require an instrument to crush the people. That's what fascism is. And what you're looking at is a form, expression of that process, which has been called in the 20th century synarchism. The evils we're talking about are the synarchists. The synarchists are, yes, Cheney is a synarchist. The neocons are synarchists. But behind them are the financial interests for which these thugs work. Therefore, the problem is, yes, it's correct. That is exactly it. But we have to recognize the actual historically determined nature of the enemy. To describe the enemy's evil does not necessarily define his vital organs, which we have to get at. The vital organ is we have to establish a national banking system as the Constitution implicitly prescribes, in which the control of the finances of the nation is under is a responsibility of government in the sense of the responsibility for the currency, and to regulate taxation and regulate other affairs such that the value of money in terms of product delivered per capita is kept so it does not inflate. What we have now is a vast inflation. Look at the prices of price of a cost of living back in the 1950s as the price of a cost of living today. Compare that with the wages that people get, the income people get back then and today. What is the physical content? What about housing? What percentage of the wage cost, wage income of a family went for housing in the 1950s and goes for housing today? The occupation of a place of residence, what is the cost in terms of the annual income of one wage earner? It used to be 20%. What is it today? Isn't it closer to 50% or higher? Isn't that why people who have jobs are homeless? Because they can't afford a place to which to live? So, therefore, the function of government is to make sure that the predatory element of finance is not able to establish institutionalized power over the state to the extent that this kind of thing can happen. The problem in Europe is they have never freed themselves from that. They have never formed a system of government which gives us the protection that our Constitution prescribes. Our Constitution's implementation has been corrupted, but we have the original constitutional intent on this matter. Therefore, this bank is to restore the idea of national banking. That is not to nationalize the banks as such, but to have control of the currency on behalf of the government done by a national banking process, which will then take the credit we're able to generate, move it through the banks to make sure it gets delivered to the place it must go in the way it must go. That's the only way to get it. We have to take responsibility for our society and everything, including the management of money. If you leave the management of money and the management of credit to an institution which is outside government and places itself above government, then you are not governing yourself. You are somebody who's working for that financial interest, and that's what the problem is. And that's why I get so much trouble, because the bankers like the Felix Rohatins and so forth, who attended Middlebury School, he's an alumnus of Middlebury School, that these guys know what I am and know what I represent. They know two things also. They know that I intend to do this and that I'm capable of doing it. Therefore, they don't want me anywhere near the presidency, because I'll do it.
So we're bringing the program now to a close. I'd just like to point out to you that, as Mr. LaRouche has said, you've just been part of a moment in history, a moment in history that's being evolved as we speak, and over the course of the next few months will evolve as perhaps the most important change in direction in our country's history. Only 2 months, in fact, less than 2 months from today, you'll have a primary in Washington, D.C. that will begin the official so-called primary season. Over the course of the months going into March, April, the LaRouche Youth Movement has been given the task of replicating itself by the thousands and creating a kind of rolling town meeting all over the United States, not just on questions of so-called issues, but on questions of principle. And the principle representative of those principles you've just heard from here today. I think that you will agree with me that there is no one else in politics in the United States today that would seriously purport to even attempt to do what you've just seen. That if that, and to the extent that that is becomes the standard, which is something you can all help us make occur, of discourse among our people, I think we can be confident that the Republic will not only survive, but that the immediate necessity of removing Cheney and others from power, that that republic survives, can be effected, that can be achieved. So, again, when you leave, Bill's now in here with us, and you can see him in the back and do what you must do to support our campaign, and also the activities of the campaign. If there are those of you who want to be involved in various ways with that, we have all kinds of things for people to do. And I would just ask if there are any further remarks that Mr. LaRouche would like to make. He seems to have closed out the program, but would just anything else you'd like to say, Lynn?
Well, I should say on this occasion, as a native-born New Hampshire man, I just revisited the place again, had a grand time in Concord, a nice reception from the Secretary of State, who was an old acquaintance, and a well-informed gentleman. We had a nice time with the press conference there. It's quite good. It's recorded. You can have access to it. And I lived for a number of years in the state of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and became acquainted with what were then its afflictions and its advantages. And I found the afflictions have increased greatly since that time. And it makes me a little bit upset. Of course, there are two things in Massachusetts as in New England. We have the tradition of the Mathers and the Winthrops from the 17th century and early 18th century. We have the great tradition of a Massachusetts-born man, Benjamin Franklin, who is the true father of this nation, who made possible the paternity supplied by George Washington. And we also had in Massachusetts and New England, we had the Essex Junto, a creation of the Lowells and the similar types, who were beholden to the British East India Company. And they became known as the treasonous Essex Junto. And the conflicts I've run into, political conflicts I run into today in New Hampshire or Vermont or Massachusetts or elsewhere, I find are echoes of the old quarrels of Franklin and his friends against the Essex Junto. It's the same fight all over again. This time we should win.
So I want you to join me in thanking Mr. LaRouche for spending his time with us here today.